There is clearly a danger that the poll tax process might lead to some kind of universal personal identifier or an ID card system.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on 31st of October. Yes, it's Halloween 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share some moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the City of London's Masonic UK Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire. At holylandradio.com, that's from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Central Time, and 97.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist, zero trust agenda, psyops, satanic stuff. Bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. The sort of thing that you would put on the television if the viewers were your enemy. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the rentier class, the World War III or wage slavery. From those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to all the crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, migrants, COVID, farming, prisons, cost of living, NHS, the accelerationist Armageddonist solutions crafted to make every crisis worse. Have the cabinet sold their souls to the devil because the politicians have nothing to say? I guess the cabinet have got their own special celebration tonight. Nick Land's dark enlightenment, social Darwinist control freaks and the underlings want us as slaves to their AI, or dead maybe. Albert Pike's World War III plan is a big taboo. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on Prince Harry, on Prince Andrew. Oh, sorry, can't call him Prince anymore. And the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. Anyone who's not their mates, in fact. The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn kids, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves. With the help, like the jabs, of a doctor, Netanyahu accused the King of Chaos, rolling out his blood-red carpet for the Zionist man-god Messiah Antichrist to come, but it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Helping us navigate through the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain and around the world, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Amongst this week's guests, we've got a brand new book out by Hedley Rees, all about the supply chain, the global supply chain for pharmaceuticals, what's wrong with what we've got and how to fix it all. This is his first book since the COVID era. Hedley is an expert in all of this, so we have a little chat with him about all that, plus some revelations about some big changes that were made in the 1980s to the law that have helped the pharmaceutical industry not have to take responsibility for what they're doing. We hear from Nick Georges. He's a former Palestine Action activist, still with the Palestine Solidarity campaign. A pretty of a horrific bit of news from him about a violent attack by a bunch of Tommy Robinson's thugs on a bunch of pensioners, plus from Jamia, and she is in Gaza. So we've heard that Fatima is okay, but she can't do reports. Jamia can, so we're going to be hearing something exclusive report from Gaza from her. Also from Steve Hall, who's the economist from the Workers' Party, but also, of course, he's a criminologist and an economist in his own right, Professor Steve Hall. So, Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM. Boring old Community FM. But by the Bristol Mafia and from the People's Republic of Stokescroft by the trans lobby, but not cancelled from here yet. So we're going to start, Martin, with our sort of theme for the first hour here is going to be looking at the economy. As I said to you just before we started broadcasting, we're getting some bad news from China about their economy, which I'll go into in a minute. But it seems to me that more important in Britain is not bad news about the economy. It's managing the news and also pretending that things that are going wrong, in other words, monopolistic price hikes in electricity, for example, are somehow good for growth, and this is a positive spin on the economy. So would you like to just compare what's going on in Britain and China?
Well, I mean, you'll have to hear what you've got to say about China. I mean, there's obviously the big news about the relations between China and the West is that Xi and Trump met in South Korea yesterday, and there was some kind of, you know, attempt to try and, you know, align their policies. But of course, the showdown is coming between the West and China, and of course and the rest of the world.
I didn't ask you about that, though, did I? I asked you about the economy in China.
The economy in China is actually in better shape than ours, let's put it that way.
I just get the impression that they're absolutely honest. They're saying, well, look, the world economy's turned down, so our economy's turned
down.
Yes,
I mean, obviously, they are affected.
They were the big industrial power of planet Earth, and their influence is bound to go down.
They are affected by all of the turmoil in the global economy created by Trump's tariff policies, and also, of course, they've got certain imbalances in the way their economy functions. They've allowed a debt, a property bubble to develop, all of which is true, but nevertheless, they're in much better shape than the United States of America or Britain, because we're in a terminal phase of, you know, we're being properly deindustrialized now. There will be nothing left.
We have been deindustrialized.
Won't be anything left after this next passage of play.
Germany, of course, as well, has been deindustrialised, and there is I've got it lined up for us to have a look at today, but I was watching some fascinating stuff this week about the German economy and the fact that you've got big companies like Siemens and Volkswagen are laying people off, shutting factories. This is an extremely negative thing, because it isn't just the German economy. The German economy is the hub of the whole of the European economy.
Well, that's right. And of course, a lot of this is now, there's not a lot to be done about it, because the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the refusal to engage with Russia, which is the solution for European problems, means that we are going to probably suffer the worst. You know, the living standards in Europe, including Britain, are going to be the one, we're going to take the full hit.
Well, sticking with China for now, the Chinese government has announced today a contraction in industrial activity. The Chinese government has announced on Friday the industrial activity in the country contracted in October, marking the seventh consecutive month of decline. The National Bureau of Statistics says that the official Managers Index, Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, for the manufacturing sectors fell to 50 points in October compared to, 49 points compared to 49.8 points in September. A worse than expected drop, reading below 50, indicates contraction in the sector. US President Donald Trump announced on Thursday, following a meeting with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in South Korea, that he would reduce tariffs imposed on China due to fentanyl from 20 to 10%, thereby lowering US tariffs on Chinese goods from 57 to 47%. HSBC economist Taylor Wang stated that the reduction in tariffs on Chinese exports would allow them to regain more competitiveness in the US market. We will see some recovery in direct exports to the US, but Wei Lai, a great name for an economist, head of the multi-asset investment at BNP, Paribas Securities Group in China. This is a Western company, isn't it, BNP? I would have thought. Yeah. Believes that despite the progress made in the tariff truce, global uncertainty casts a shadow over manufacturing confidence. So they're giving us a little warning, aren't they? And these agreements between Washington and Beijing are unlikely to prevent further deterioration rather than driving any kind of real strong recovery. So it's all falling to bits, slowly but surely. And that actually, I got that story from the Yemen news agency, Sabah. That's sabah.ye, which has got all sorts of good stuff on. They're very good, actually, as a general international news source, much better than, say the BBC, etc. It's a little bit like watching the Yemeni news. It's a little bit like reading, say, RT or something like that, which is, it's probably more likely like the old Syrian news service before that country was taken over by the West. So, anyway, if it's not good for China, it's not good for Germany. Britain is... I mean, what on earth can Rachel Reeves do? Is there any way to actually kickstart the economy? Or is she just managing a slow destruction and decline?
Well, she would like to say that we're going to go for growth and then everything's going to be sorted out by, the economy, growing in some moderate fashion, which will then solve the problem. But of course, the headwinds against that are pretty bad, as you've just pointed out. The global situation is not good, and it's very difficult. But it's impossible, really, for small countries
Britain to butler. We just need a war. That will kick
well,
the economy
going.
Well,
we've got a war. We've got a war with Russia, but it's not helping anything, is it? Not for the West. There's problems in the Russian economy as well, because Nybulina, who's the head of the central bank, wants to raise interest rates to bring inflation down, and that will essentially reduce the Russian growth rate to zero. There's plenty of Russian economists aren't very happy with her policy, but that's because she's basically a holdover from the Yeltsin era, and they're saying, well, she shouldn't be pursuing this kind of policy. But, obviously everything's connected to everything else. You know, if the US economy, for example, really takes a dive, which I suspect it might, that will affect everybody because they are at the centre of what goes on.
Now, I would, if I were on speaking terms with him, he puts the phone down on me every time I phone him up. I don't know why he doesn't keep my number in his phone and put, Nasty Gosling. There's a guy called Richard Murphy. I think he seems to be the guy that's steering most of the economic policy of the Labour government at the moment.
He's not a member of the government.
No, he's not, but they're picking up loads of his ideas. One of the things that he's been talking about is the idea of one of the things that you could still tax, even though all the other taxes have been so desperately counterproductive, things like upping national insurance, closing medium businesses and small businesses, is the property tax. So you just find what property people have got, and you start taxing that more. And this is one of the things that Reeves is definitely looking at. I mean, they're also talking about breaking their pledge not to raise income tax, of course. But there's an interesting article in the iPaper, all the property taxes Reeve could increase or change, and how likely they are. She's keeping the option of higher property tax on the table, and she draws up plans for a budget that will need to fill a black hole in the public finances estimated at more than £20 billion. So where's she going to get that £20 billion from, Martin?
Well, the one thing is it's a black hole because she's given herself these self-imposed limits on how much she's allowed to spend, which is, of course, basically copying the Tories and saying, well, we've got to cover this black hole. She could just say, well, we don't care about that. But she won't do that because she will then be drifting off the park in terms of what, the mainstream financial press and so on want her to do. But of course, we've got no doubt that if you've got Steve Hall from the Workers' Party. I mean, there's plenty of things you could do, but you've got to stop thinking like as if you were a Tory chancellor. But of course, that's
well, you say plenty. It'd be interesting before we hear from Steve to see what you've got to say, because they're now saying here, well, lots and lots of people have got quite a lot of value in property, whether that's homes or other forms of property, and this is a great way to just raise loads of tax. Well, to tell them that you have to pay, I mean, it's basically like a kind of a council tax of some sort, to up that, so you're paying maybe £5,000 a year for the pleasure of owning a house. But many people also arguing, well, people who've bought homes, they have all paid tax on the money that they've paid to buy that home. And now you're saying that you can't keep what you've already paid tax to buy. We're going to tax you, and you might be in a situation where you have to sell your house because you can't pay the tax.
Well, ultimately, what we really need to do is tax property and monopoly profits.
So this is a good idea. This is a good idea, because that's what this is. They're talking about a mansion tax, but of course, any property over £500,000 is what they're looking at. But that's most houses in London, isn't it?
It is, and of course what ultimately happens is you're either going to push poor people out of their houses, or maybe some rich people will have to downsize. Gosh, maybe but they'll have to leave the country.
I wonder if they're going to do that, actually, because these rich people generally have some sort of way to dodge these taxes, don't they? Whereas poorer people tend to pay them, and middle-class people pay them much more. But it's a basic principle, isn't it? If you've been paying tax for years, it sounds to me as if they've just run out of ideas. Okay, so they're now charging people to go in and out of towns and cities, go along roads and things like that. All the basic things that they need to do. They're charging massive amounts of money for electricity and gas for all sorts of other reasons, and that I suppose the argument is, well, if these companies make lots of money, we can then tax it and it doesn't all go to the shareholders. But it seems to me that they've run out of ideas if they're now saying, well, you've got a house, we're going to tax it.
Well, we'll have to see what she comes up with, Tony. The problem is that if the economy isn't growing, you can't just if you tax certain things, you aren't actually going to make the economy grow less. So if you're taking money out of the pockets of people who are going to spend it, that is not going to grow the economy. So you don't want to do that. Now, ultimately, of course, things like land nationalisation, which were discussed in the 1940s, come into play.
Well, they're not talking about that, are they?
No, we're not talking about that, but ultimately we are going to have to talk about things like that because that's the only solution.
They're talking
a big
about
redistribution of wealth from the wealthy to the not wealthy.
Some bright spark pointed out that Buckingham Palace is now paying something like £2,000 in council tax.
Yeah, but that's ridiculous for the size of the building that it is, isn't it? Let's face it. Of course, we could start taxing the Crown Estates, for example. If they paid tax like everybody else, that'd be a massive load of money. But we don't do that. Why not?
Having one or two additional bands for the most valuable homes for council tax is allowing councils to charge properties in those new bands more would bring in revenue for cash-strapped local authorities. Now, this is sounding a little bit more Labour, so that if you really do have a mansion, I mean, a mansion tax in London for a £1.5 million house is just a three-bedroom house if it's in the right place. That's not really a mansion; it's just a house. But it sounds as if they might be doing this through council tax for the very for people with bigger homes.
Yeah, well, it was obvious that the council tax is basically poll tax Mark II. And of course, once you reach a certain size of house, you pay exactly the same. So even very, very big houses pay the same as quite moderate houses, as you're pointing out. There's no reason for that. We should, in fact, go back to the rates, which they still have in Northern Ireland, which is a property tax. It's not a tax on individual people. It's a tax on property. And in actual fact, that's a very easy tax to collect, because if people don't pay, you just impound the property. And, you know, lots of people have made out like bandits during COVID, during the financial crisis. Some people, we bailed the banks out. Because we bailed the banks out, wealthy people didn't lose all their money. But they've actually made more money than they would otherwise have done. That's the obvious place to find the money to fill the hole, isn't it?
Well, it seems amazing that so much seems to go back to 1991, 1990 and the poll tax. This whole idea that rather than the rates, that this is an amount of money that the people are living in rather than owning the flats. Can you just talk us through why it's so important transferring that tax from the owner to the resident?
Well, in Northern Ireland, they still have the old-fashioned rates. Rates were brought in by Elizabeth I. That was when they were first brought in. And it meant that basically the property owners, because there was no such thing as income tax until the modern era, basically any tax by the government was a tax on property. And that meant, in fact, that people had to sell stuff to pay it. Yeah. So, you know, you, if you're going to pay this tax, you're going to have to sell something to give us the money. And,
Hang on. Generally speaking, if you own a house that you're not actually living in, you don't have to pay the poll tax anymore. Your resident does. But in the old days, of course, you would be paying that out of the rent that they were paying you, wouldn't you?
So
you don't obviously have a decent amount of income because you're renting the house out and the government are saying we're going to cream a bit of that off.
Yes. Well, I mean, the thing is, the ultimate goal, as Michael Hudson, the economist, pointed out, is you need to tax unearned income. Yeah. So things like capital gains tax, where you bought shares and they rise in price and you make a capital gain, that is not taxed at the same level as income tax. That's unfair. In actual fact, the goal should be have no income tax at all for low income people, and you shouldn't really tax profits either, because that discourages enterprise. But people who get money for nothing, like big landowners, Duke of Westminster, monopoly suppliers, like
shareholders.
Yeah, well, shareholders in monopoly companies and all the rest of it, they're not contributing to social product. So if you tax that, it doesn't affect the economy. Yeah, it affects the people concerned because they don't get free money. But then do you want them to have free money? The whole way the system works is to give free money to people who've already got it.
There was something desperately devious about this. In fact, I think maybe on this week's newsletter, I might attach a copy of a paper by Michael Crick that he wrote. He's an ex-Newsnight journalist. You still see him popping up around the place, a freelance journalist, who wrote a paper in 1990 about, or maybe 91, about the poll tax, about the community charge, and about who cooked this idea up and where and when. Because it was a small group of people, including Sir Keith Joseph was one of them, William Waldegrave was another. I mean, this was a little idea. I think I'm right in saying it was also Victor Rothschild was involved in this, but there were a tiny bunch of city, elite, really, that said, we're going to do this. And Margaret Thatcher just picked it up, but she thought, oh, sounds like a good idea, and ran with it.
Well, that's right. I mean, Thatcher used to have friends who lived on Streatham Hill, and she went to a party in one of their houses, and they were moaning about having to pay rates, because they had to pay quite a lot, because you can imagine.
What I'm saying is, this is a bit of a myth, because this was all cooked up by Waldegrave and the rest of them, and Keith Joseph. It wasn't actually led by Thatcher. It's just like, as so many things that happen with politicians, it's all been cooked up beforehand.
Well, she listened to these people and she liked what she heard, because she'd been told just anecdotally by people in this party that she went to that they were fed up of paying quite large amounts of money, because you can imagine Streatham Hill's quite a posh area of London, so they're a bit bigger.
Streatham isn't. Well, is that the bottom of the hill?
No, I'm talking about the top of the hill.
Okay.
Not the bottom of the hill, because the bottom of Streatham Hill is Brixton, and what they were moaning about is Lambeth Council were charging them quite a lot of money to pay for youth clubs in Brixton, and her attitude was, if people in Brixton want youth clubs, they can pay for it themselves.
This is exactly the same era, isn't it, as Fair's Fair, and Ken Livingstone, he was Greater London Council leader, he'd actually started a process of using the rates to subsidise public transport to make buses and tubes in London free.
Yes, so in other words, they got rid of the rates, and then they got rid of the GLC altogether, because it was in fact a quite useful instrument for redistribution of wealth, which is what Livingstone and the Labour Party realised, because there's quite a lot of wealth in London, and they had business rates as well, so they could easily generate quite a large amount of money by just raising the business and home rates, and then they got loads of money to spend on poor people, which is why they had to get rid of it altogether, so they can't do that anymore. So at one stage there was no government in London at all, so that nobody can redistribute. This is what they do. The wealthy classes, when they find that they're being squeezed by policies that are being adopted, they just dismantle the institutions which allow that to happen. So the modern London, Greater London Council, has gotten a completely different kind of finances and set up from the previous one. Because they got rid of all of that.
It's the London Mayor, isn't it?
But I mean, they've got the powers that they have.
The London Assembly.
Powers that they have to raise taxes and do stuff have been completely destroyed. Yeah. And that's the whole point. They don't want people redistributing wealth. It's our wealth. We don't want to redistribute it.
Those days in the 1980s where County Hall, opposite the Houses of Parliament, used to have the unemployment figures, didn't it? Put on the... So every time any of the MPs drove across or walked across Westminster Bridge, they would have the failures of the Tory government employment failures rubbed in their face day after day after day, which was wonderful, which is one of the reasons that it was then abolished. Anyway, well done, Ken, in those days. But look, let's go back now to 1990 and to 1991 and listen to a clip, because as you probably remember from last week, I had Mark Saunders speaking, who was this filmmaker in London. We went to a celebration of his life last week. Bumped into some very interesting people there as well, people I've never met before, some I've known for many years. And my last chit-chat with Mark had been just about 2 months before he died. I'd been to the Museum of Docklands at Canary Wharf. We'd been around there, spent the best part of the day. It's an absolutely brilliant museum. If you're ever in London or around Canary Wharf area, it's the whole history of the London Docklands, and I suppose the sort of industrial heritage of London to a large extent from those docks over the centuries. And Mark Saunders' film, Despite the Sun, was celebrated in the museum because it was part of the Wapping dispute, which I know you were involved a little bit in, Martin, too, which was when Rupert Murdoch sacked a whole load of print workers in order to really break the trade unions in the newspaper industry, and he successfully did that. So we're going to hear now a little clip from a video, I think it's called Despite the Poll Tax, Despite the Sun and Despite the Poll Tax. I think this is where Mark talks about these two films. So he made a film, Despite the Sun, about the Wapping dispute in the 1980s, closely followed by Despite the Poll Tax, which was about some of the hidden motivations behind the poll tax. This was all being, both these films made late 1980s and 1990.
Most media never wanted to antagonise Murdoch, and that's still true. So the BBC, when Kate Adey, some of you may know the name, when Kate Adey and her film crew were hospitalised on that 3rd of May, they tried to hospitalise us, but they didn't get us, but they got them. The BBC didn't even make a formal complaint. And Kate Adey was so pissed off, she went into self-exile and left the UK and was a foreign correspondent somewhere in Japan or something for a long time. So we were used to this idea that you could look at footage, not just from the point of view of, oh, this is footage, but this is, like we were saying in another session, this is data. You know, this is like you could, you know, well, maybe we do have a shot of that, or we have a shot of, you know, that person earlier in the evening. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways that you might use the material. And it was a film that we managed to finish about halfway through the dispute, which meant that it was actually the union who were fundraising bootlegged it, which we were kind of grateful for, because we couldn't afford to make 600 copies or whatever it was, but they bootlegged it and sold it on the picket line as a way of fundraising for the strike. There were loads of screenings. We launched it in a hall which had a capacity of 200 or 300 people, and it was sold out. People couldn't get in to watch it. And this is just local people. And there were lots of little spin-off, like, you know, there's a sit-down that you just start to see before that. What was it called again? A fade-out, yeah. But just before the... that was the beginning of a sit-down shoot, and that was used by the community in other meetings and blah, 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 and civil defence, group defence. So we had some experience of, the thing, it wasn't subtle. The cops would suddenly come out onto the street from the printing press, from the print plant. And amongst them, there would be people, there would be all these uniformed cops in riot gear. And like every sort of one in 40 of them was someone in plain clothes and a motorbike helmet. And then later in the dispute, I'd be looking over my shoulder and there's a guy dressed exactly like that, throwing bricks at the police, going, come on, everyone, let's, you know. And that gives them an excuse to send the snatch squads in. So we were pretty well trained in how public order works. You know, there's all kinds of little subtle things that we learned. And some people have come, used our archive, because it would appear that the police deliberately target women on these kind of demonstrations so that the blokes try and go in to defend them. So they're not like picking a fight with the blokes, because that would be too obvious, but they kind of manhandle and push around the women. And of course, their partner or brother or friend or whatever, you know, might kind of, you know, push a riot cop away. Suddenly, bang, 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 they're all in, grab them, and they find themselves in the sup. So we learnt a lot. A few years later, in 1990, we were making a single-issue magazine about the poll tax. The poll tax was a tax that replaced a property progressive, you know, you pay, the bigger your property was, the more you pay type tax, with a poll tax, which means every individual, regardless of their personal wealth, pays a same amount. So you had, like, the richest man in the UK, the Duke of Westminster, paid £80 a year. But if you had a house in Brixton with an extended Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean family with, you know, some of the adults are unemployed and lower income, they all have to pay each the same as the Duke of Westminster. So, you know, people were a bit upset about that. But really, what we made our programme about, the theme of our Despite the Poll Tax, was that you can only enforce poll tax, and this was the real trick, if you have ID cards. The South African pass laws, that every black African had to have a pass, was when they kind of went into South Africa, no one wanted to work in the horrible factories and mills, so they said, well, you have to pay a tax, and the only way you can pay that tax is if you earn money in our mills. So it was like, that's the strategy. It also means you can track where everyone is. It's a colonial instrument. They did try introducing it in the UK in the 13th century, no, 14th century, I'm exaggerating, 14th century, 1381. And the peasants, the medieval peasants, thought it wasn't fair and revolted. It was the peasants' revolt. You can look it up. It's the only real mass revolt in this country in sort of 2,000 years. And it was because they tried to introduce a poll tax. So the poll tax was actually about having to have data pass. Identity cards, how do you know if people have paid it if you can't track who they are? And this was an issue that was being ignored in the mainstream media, I mean, as it's known now, but the media wasn't. Everything in the media was about how unfair it was economically. We were looking at it from a social, political, surveillance, policing angle. So we'd nearly finished our magazine. It was made up. It was all a bit of this and a bit of that, bits of humour and playing around with, I think the opening scene is a map from the original poll tax painting that opens up like the old TV show Bonanza, where it burns out from the middle and stuff like that. And it was just it was very playful, but it had lots of quite hard-hitting points about what poll tax implications were. And we thought, well, it would be really good just to go and film some scenes for the opening and ending credits. There was a big demonstration planned, 31st of March, in Trafalgar Square. And we had three cameras, and we thought, well, let's put one near the end, one at the front, near the front, and one in the middle of the march. And it was almost, I think we did have one mobile phone with us, but the battery ran out after 2 hours. You know, one of those like, brick ones. We're talking about 1990, sorry. Let's watch this. This is the opening. It was broadcast on Channel 4, actually.
So that's the voice of Mark Saunders taking us through Despite the Sun and a bit about Despite the Poll Tax, and then he finishes off with the Battle of Trafalgar. This was a very important era, as we're now finding out, Martin, wasn't it? It wasn't just the 2008 bailouts that clobbered local authorities. The council tax, in a way, was doomed to fail. And we were hearing last week from Acorn that the council here are now saying, well, if poor people can't afford to pay the council tax, we're not going to send the bailiffs around.
Which makes sense, because in actual fact, you're not going to get the money you're going to get out of people is possibly less than the money you're going to spend on the bailiffs. This is how stupid the tax is. It's very difficult to collect.
In theory, you know, Rachel Reeves could just finish it, couldn't she?
She could. I mean, if she was going to be radical, she'd say, we're going to abolish council tax and we're going to bring back the rates. and that would actually solve the problems of local authorities overnight.
Well, this is nearly half an hour, but it's Steve Hall, Professor Steve Hall, retired from his job as a criminologist and economist and sociologist up north in Newcastle-on-Tyne, discussing the state of the British economy. And actually, we spent quite a long time, as you'll hear, talking about the solutions and also the poking holes in all of the lies that we'll be hearing over the next few weeks in the run-up and during Rachel Reeves's budget.
My name's Professor Steve Hall, speaking from Newcastle. I'm in the Workers' Party of Great Britain, and I run the Economics Forum. And we do work on the party's economics policies and try to inform committees, various committees and leaders, about the party's political messaging regarding economics and finance.
Now, Steve, one thing I've always felt about economics ever since school, I've never studied it, but I've always felt it's a bit of a dark art. The idea is that there is a little club that you can join called economists, and they understand what's going on, and they're not really interested in letting the rest of us know what it's all about.
Yes, I think, it's often been described as more of an art than a science, but I prefer the term an art dressed as a science, because they use an awful lot of equations to explain dynamic relationships between quantities, prices and demand curves and supply curves, this sort of thing. And they tend to get it hopelessly wrong, don't they? Remember 2008, only a handful of economists got this right, including my good friend Professor Steve Keen. And they use these things called dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, believe it or not. Now, that's a mouthful, but what it means is that they think that prices and demand and supply float around this equilibrium, and markets are magic vehicles, they're magic mechanisms for finding that equilibrium point and making sure everybody gets what they want at the right price, and the firms make the right profits, and the government take the right tax, and everything's going to be hunky-dory, and we're going to, on the road to Nirvana, just have faith in the market, and everything will be okay. Well, 1929, 2008, and then there's world wars and resource wars and regime change. We know that's utter nonsense. The economy is now global, of course. And basically, then, you could regard it as a pseudo-religion. It's something that has faith in the market. Not total faith. They know that the market can be volatile. They know that it can be a problem at certain times, and particularly if governments do the wrong thing. So they tend to blame governments. They're too taxing too much. They're not taxing enough. They're spending too much. They're interfering with the market, distorting it. And then if governments leave markets alone, they correct themselves. And they seem to think the market has magic powers. But what they leave out all the time is this thing called agency. Human beings who make decisions about things like prices and production and what sort of stuff people should get. And they blame, they say, oh, the Soviet Union fell apart because, bureaucrats and Gosplan, the central office in Moscow, were planning stuff and they couldn't plan. They didn't know. But that's what they do. They're planning stuff all the time. They're looking at market signals, obviously, but they're making plans and they're making decisions. And their decisions are the ones that cause the problems.
We've got a bunch of economics correspondents for the national press, TV, radio and newspapers up in London. It frustrates me that some basic questions never seem to get asked by them. And I'm going to ask you one of them now, which is, how do we know if the financial system is serving humanity or enslaving humanity?
That's a profound question at the heart of economics, and that's something they're not prepared to answer. And when they are prepared to answer, they refer it to so-called experts who are all neoliberals and, believe in neoclassical economics. And what they will say is the market is actually an arena of free activity. So it frees humanity. They say that it allows humanity to make all of these billions of decisions, and this magic market will tell producers what to produce, and everybody gets what they want at the right price. That's what they believe. And it'll go wrong now and again, and you'd have to correct it a little bit, but, you know, it'll correct itself if you leave it alone. People will suffer. Everyone gets unemployed. Businesses will close. You'll have a recession, and you'll have high crime and populism, but all that stuff will all blow over eventually, and the market will get us back on track. I mean, basically, they're mad. And we're in the grip of a mad cult. So anyone who believes that is really is not a thinking, independent person, but a member of a congregation who believes. And we're not supposed to believe. We're supposed to believe in spiritual, you know, spiritual things. We're not supposed to believe that there are mechanisms on Earth that are performing miracles, but that's what they want us to believe in. So it doesn't exactly enslave us. It is an authority. It disciplines us. It punishes us if we do the wrong thing. You know, you've heard about the bond vigilantes selling off bonds and the foreign currency exchange traders selling off your currency, causing inflation, causing business to close, making your imports more expensive and all of this. So it has a disciplinary authority that stands over you. If you do anything wrong, you're punished. But of course, a punishment has to be decided. So there are people, powerful people operating in the money markets who make these decisions. So really, it doesn't enslave us. It creates what Hamid Minsky called upwards instability. And that is, the more successful it is and the more stable it becomes, the more likely everyone, all the investors and the business people get too excited, speculate, and the whole thing comes crashing down like it did.
Well, look, what about this term wage slavery? I mean, it might be in a bit of an exaggeration, the sort of thing used by anarchists, etc. But some people do feel enslaved in their jobs. They actually want to leave the job. They can't find another job. They've got a mortgage or whatever. They've got a family to support, and they do feel trapped, Steve.
So that's debt slavery. So they only need the wage because they can't get what they want, and they need to get it in debt to get it. So if they weren't in debt all of the time, they could still do work. They could do work independently and get paid for it. They could choose how much work they could do. They could maybe reduce the working week, or they could maybe go part-time, or they could work around their family circumstances or the community, or what the community needs. And if they weren't in so much debt, they could tailor. There's always going to be an element of wage slavery, because we create surpluses. That's what work is about, creating a surplus. But who gets that surplus is a question, of course. We should get that surplus. So in a sense, we're always enslaved to ourselves because we've got to do work. And work is, you know, it's compulsory. I'd rather you just use the word compulsory rather than slavery. So, but it's the debt that enslaves us, because we've got to earn so much money, a certain amount of money, to pay off our debts. And I think someone was telling me the other day, who's expert in, I'm not an expert in housing and land. I think you probably know more about land than I do, actually. But someone was saying that on average, we're paying 44% of our income on rent. So we're enslaved to the landlord, and
landlord class. And of course, most of the local authorities and the government have basically given up on building this council housing. But look, another thing that the Faisal Islams, the Ben Chews, the Robert Pestons, these correspondents don't really talk about is growth. Well, they say growth is, if you want to use your religious analogy, it's almost like an icon at the front of the church is this thing called growth. Now, it strikes me that growth is a good thing in some circumstances, but there's both good and bad growth. So when you get a doubling in rail fares or electricity prices or rents, that's growth.
Yes. Well, the problem is that they express growth with this thing called GDP, gross domestic product. The problem is, you know, like inflation. I mean, inflation's a will of the wisp as well, because you have different indexes. You know, you have a consumer price index and all other indexes will measure inflation in different ways. They, at one time, I can't remember the year it was, somewhere in the late 80s, 90s, they actually removed housing from the inflation index. CPA. So now that all that huge asset inflation that, you know, we think is, was created by irresponsible lending, lending people stuff, you know, loans that right to the limit of their ability to pay. Well, we, you know, that was, you know, removed from the index. And now we have a different conception of inflation. It's all smoke and mirrors. I mean, these are just fingers, numbers on accountant sheets. So, yes, we have this GDP thing, which is gross domestic product. The problem is we have a huge shadow economy, some of it criminal. Now, a lot of the transactions aren't contributing to GDP. So what growth in what? So what is it? It's growth as measured by accountants. And in a financialized economy, you can have huge growth in the City of London, make lots of profit, paying tax. And you call that growth. But growth in areas we want, growth in rail, for instance, growth in community is, you know, we want things for the community.
How
we want better roads,
growth
better
in
pavements.
Wages? We never hear
growth
about
in wages
that.
Would be a good, oh, well, that's inflationary, you see. That's, they say that's inflationary because they use a notion of demand pull inflation. They say, well, if there's too much money around, this is Friedman and his ugly crew, you know, if there's too much money around, then people will automatically raise prices. Why automatically? Ask that question. Why automatically? I mean, there's more money around. They just want more of it. So that's greed. That's profit maximization, often with shareholders in meetings telling them that they want more. Everyone wants more. So then they put up prices. So the wages are, you know, boost aggregate demand too much and cause inflation. Well, actually, inflation isn't demand driven. It's demand enabled. I use that distinction, which some, I'm glad as a social scientist that some economists are starting to take notice of that now, because I think this is a qualitative distinction between demand driven and demand enabled. A lot of demand there enables people to put up prices, but it doesn't force them to put up prices. It's the prices that cause the inflation. So we get everything the wrong way around, but because of neoclassical economists look at the world through the wrong end of the telescope. They look at the world from the financial economy to the real economy instead of looking from the real economy to what the financial economy can do to help it.
Well, look, you mentioning housing, particularly rent, etc.
Yeah.
This is a massive slice, an increasing slice of people's
massive,
wages.
Yeah.
It's also very unrealistic if you're looking at how much it actually costs physically to build a house, the materials
yeah.
and the man hours go into it, to
yeah.
actually buy one or to rent one. Well, you're
yeah.
talking about astronomical figures in comparison to,
oh.
you know, a home lasting for 100 years, 150 years or whatever. And so there are questions about this whole thing of demand for housing being increased. The government now saying, well, we're going to get private house builders to build all over the countryside, relax planning laws. But it seems to me that maybe it's mass migration, which is one of the things that's been driving this up. So the economy itself hasn't really been doing very much at all in terms of growth. The only growth has been coming from the housing market going up, new houses being built because of mass migration. So is this mass migration, do you think, good for the economy? That's the question.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, what we're talking about is a growth in what economists, well, the better economists anyway, proper economists, call financialization. We have in Britain and in the USA too, financialized economy. So we see growth in loans and growth in all of these financial instruments, derivatives and all the rest. We see that it is as growth. Well, it isn't. It's simply growth in the transactions that are being made between lenders and borrowers. And there's no growth in the real economy. I mean, we're not growing useful services and like health and education, and we're not paving roads and doing all the stuff people want. So we've got this huge asset bubble that was blown up 40 odd years ago. Oh, no, guess who got in 40-odd years ago, you know, and released capital controls and deregulated everything and deregulated the lending, the banks, and told everyone that they should buy their own council houses. Well, I mean, you're probably old enough like me to remember all that happening, Tony. And everyone thought it was going to be great. They were going to be property owners, like John Locke said, you know, life and liberty and property and all the rest of it, and they're going to be free property owners. And they ended up getting in loads of debt. But, of course, they paid that off. Inflation started paying that, a lot of that debt off, and making their debt cheaper. So they took out consolidation loans. Do you remember these things in the 1980s and 1990s? Oh, borrow some more money on your house, on your mortgage, and get yourself into further debt, and go on holiday, and just enjoy yourself, live for the day. And it was all this debt was mounting up. And the financial economy loved this because they trade debts as assets on the derivatives market. So they actually sell your debts to each other. And then they have these things called credit default swaps and other instruments, which actually insure them against losses. And then they short sell and long sell. And then they have all of these weird and wonderful instruments and methods of transaction, and they make loads of money out of it by trading in your debt. So the more debt you're in, the more they can trade. The whole thing is utterly disastrous. It crashed in 2008 due to irresponsible lending, and it will crash again.
Because it didn't quite crash, did it? It was almost teetering on the brink, and the government bailed them out.
Well, this is the libertarians and neoliberals argue that government should stand back and get out of the way. But every time they make a mess of it, it has to step in and give them this thing called QE. It was a term invented by the economist. I think it was Richard Werner from Southampton who invented that term. It's basically called quantitative easing, where banks buy back loads of bonds and they shove money into the bank's reserve accounts. It's non-inflationary because it simply disappears in the banks of reserve accounts. The money has to be circulating and being spent to enable demand, enable prices to rise. Let's use that word enable, not drive. So they just disappears in the bank's accounts. It's actually about giving the banks their liquidity back. So they start lending again, but they didn't because they were, it was risky and demand was down and they didn't want to lend too much money out. So we had this thing called austerity. Let's all cut our belts. The banks aren't lending. Let's minimize welfare. Let's just get people doing awful jobs in the service economy, the zero-hour contracts, and let's let people get by in anywhere. We had this huge expansion. I worked in criminology departments for a long time, looking at sort of economic crime, financial crime, violence, all of these sort of crimes. And this is how I came to economics through looking at that. And the huge criminal shadow economies all over the country. They're not necessarily violent. They're not necessarily doing an alarm, or is intimidation, violence part of it? But they have, people just do, basically, used to call it the black market before political correctness set in. We call it the shadow economy now. And it doesn't count GDP. It's not counted in GDP, but it's part of the wealth creation of the country. People are making transactions, getting their hands on stuff and selling it all the time. We don't know how big that shadow economy is. There's no proper research into it. And, it obviously stands to reason, doesn't it? Because it's a shadow economy. It's in the shadows. You can't see what's going on. You need some very intrepid ethnographers and researchers to expose it. So this country's in quite a big mess, but we don't really know how big a mess it's in. Because we're not, as you say.
Another problem too, Steve. And that is, we're seeing a lot of cartels and monopolies operating, which are crowding out. I mean, I'm just thinking about something as simple as the Baker's, Greggs, or Weatherspoons and the pub chains. So some of these, they're starting to monopolize markets. It's big companies coming into many, many towns around the country and crowding out the small family businesses that used to happen. And also, of course, you've got an overlap here with some supermarkets owning organizations. So this is, say, for example, a private equity firm that owns a chain of supermarkets and another chain will merge the two, say, like we see Argos shops popping up in Sainsbury's stores. So really, the small local business can't compete with these big multinationals because they've also... Many of their profits are being made abroad, and they've got a whole bunch of smart accountants making sure they're paying little or no tax.
That's right. And we add to that disposability and inbuilt obsolescence, where things just be thrown away. And do you remember when people used to come around, fix your washing machine, fix your TV, these guys in these, coats used to come around and with tools and fix things. That's all gone. So, there's a bit obsolescence is built into most products. We've got monopolies in almost everything. Music business, for instance, globally is two big companies. Own almost all the subsidiary record labels, and the platforms where you now buy music, and you know, you pay whatever it is per month on Spotify, or 12 or 14 quid or whatever it is, you get any tune in the world. How are the artists getting their royalties? They're getting about 0.003 of a pound for plays, you know, and they're getting nothing.
Well, let me just weigh in here on the radio stations, because we've now got thousands of franchises, or hundreds anyway, of franchises around the country owned by the same group. Usually it's Global or one of these radio stations based in London, and they amalgamate five or six franchises that they've managed to win into one station, and then they pretend that they've got a news service for each area, but really it's just one newsroom with a slightly different bulletin going out in each. So that's happening too. But anyway, look, all of this, what I really called you about is none of this really, Steve. This is the background, is about Rachel Reeves's budget coming up, because she's looking at breaking the election pledge about no rise in income tax. She's already caused a lot of trouble for small businesses by raising the national insurance payments for employers, and there's also the inheritance tax on farmers seems to be about to kick in. She's quite into the idea of property taxes. Now people are arguing, well, we've already paid tax, quite a lot of tax, on the money that we've used to buy this property, and now you're going to try and take it away from us. So if you could just give us an overview of what you think she might do and what she should do.
Well, the problem is, that, of course, that neoclassical economists are basically institutionalized liars, and they're lying on behalf of what, you know, we call the creditor class, those who are in charge of issuing currencies, sovereign currencies, and bank credit, issuing that out for interest-bearing loans. The other way you can issue currency is directly through the government, and of course, they charge no interest. So they want to keep it that way. And taxes don't pay for public spending. This is something agreed by most heterodox economists. Mainstream economists try to suppress this, but it's the fact that taxes don't pay
for public spending. Well, hang on. We keep hearing that she's got to balance the books. We keep hearing that.
Well, you don't have to balance. The books are never balanced. Books have never been balanced since 1694. It's absolute nonsense. And if you look at every time the government has tried to balance the books by reducing the deficit and even moving towards a surplus, even Bill Clinton in the 1990s, you moved towards recession, because what you're doing is reducing the government's net contribution to the money supply. And if the banks aren't lending, you get a lower money supply. There are two types of money supply. There's the stock, which is accumulated amount of money, and there's the flow, which is the money circulating around every day. You reduce both of those, and you reduce demand, and producers start to, close down and sack people, and then that reduces aggregate demand further. Then they start putting up interest rates, and then they start talking about a recession. So this ridiculous notion that the idea of balancing the books is the books are meant to be imbalanced, because if you balance the book, there's no money around if you balance the books, because the assets and liabilities will cancel to zero. I mean, this is just, you know, this is schoolboy
math. You want to end up
with
America, do you, with trillions more debt every year?
Well, that debt is a government debt, is actually not really debt. And that's another thing that's misunderstood. There's absolutely no need for a currency-issuing government to borrow money from the reserve accounts of rich institutions like banks, insurance funds, pension funds, mega-rich individuals, and all the corporations, and all the rest of it. You don't have to borrow their money. You've got a printing press. You can print it. Does printing money cause inflation? Well, only if people put prices up when there's more money around. So stop putting prices up, you know. But they won't, because their job is profit maximization. The whole system, it's a doom loop. There's no way out of this, because the system runs on the wrong principles. And I can't emphasize enough how inevitable recession and crash, as recessions and crashes are going to be, because that's the way we're going, you know. So there's no need to sell bonds. I could go back to 12th century Venice, the Rialto market, when basically originally bonds were the other way around. Bankers, the first bankers who had kept people's coins in strong rooms and then started to keep accounts and tell people they had more money in the strong rooms than they actually had. And then that led to paper money and all the rest of it centuries later. They had to pay the Doge, the governor of Venice, a bond. So in case they lost their clients' money, they had something to pay them back. But that was reversed in the Netherlands, where actually the bond is, they give the bond to the government and the government allegedly spends it, you know. But you can't spend money from a reserve account. It's nonsense. And then you get all sorts of complex accounting and, you know, in the way the fiat money system works. It was all tied to gold then, of course.
So can you just explain this term fiat money?
Well, fiat money is money that's a free-floating exchange which is created by governments. It's simply printed by the central bank, and it's issued either directly as government spending on the one hand or indirectly through bank credit by banks licensed to issue that money for interest. So that all comes from the same source, the banks, the clearing banks. The investment banks and the shadow banking industry do this thing called leveraging, where they have special deals with the banks. They borrow money from the banks at very low interest rate, around about the LIBOR rate, you know, which is very low, below the base rate usually. And I think always, I can't think of a time when it wasn't, I might be wrong, below the base rate. And then they invest it. And so if they're borrowing it, I don't know, 1 or 1.5%, and then they're getting 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% returns, they're just making loads of money out of the state's ability to allow banks to issue their money under license. It's a setup. I mean, this has evolved now for 900 years, Tony.
Well, we need to break this somehow. So anyway, you were in Rachel Reeves's shoes and you could make some really radical changes other than using the Bank of England to just pay off the trillions in debt that the government is running up, which seems like a very sensible instant solution. Everybody's happy. What else should she be doing to adjust the way they collect taxes, the way they spend money in order to get the country back on its feet?
Do you want me an honest answer? Do you want the honest answer?
Yeah.
Nothing. She can't do anything. As soon as, of course, the central bank would buy back the bonds and we could go, you know, direct public spending. Private investors could play catch up in the wake. We could nationalize, utilities and nationalize the banking system. Why not? We can nationalize rail. We can nationalize major manufacturing, steel, and energy. And well, energy first and foremost, I think we could do all of that. But as soon as we do that, the bond vigilantes attack. They start selling off the bonds or refusing to buy them, driving up the yields, which has a knock-on effect of driving up interest rates. And then the foreign exchange monkeys start selling off your currency on the foreign exchanges and driving down the value of your currency, causing inflation, making imports more expensive. All the businesses close. And then you're out, the government's out as fast as Liz Truss.
Well, I wonder that. I was thinking of Liz Truss as you're saying that. Do you think that that was what happened with... She actually had some plans that might have worked that the city didn't like?
They wouldn't have worked, but the city didn't like them. What she planned to do was the opposite. She planned to actually lower taxes, which the city didn't like, because they know, I'm telling no one they know, but they know that that will cause inflation, leave too much aggregate demand. She hoped that aggregate demand would attract investment from abroad. This is, you know, Larry Fink and BlackRock and Vanguard and all the rest of them. They're going to flood the country with money and set up new businesses, and they're all going to sort of go back to the 18th century, and we're going to have this organic growth of, you know, small and medium businesses, and everything's going to be put back the way that it was intended. And it's complete and absolute nonsense, because, of course, private equity is not going to invest in this country. We've got high energy costs are massive, rail costs are too high, and our wages are high because we've got an overvalued currency. And we rely on cheap imports. Tony, this is a mess. I don't know if I'm going to want to go any further, because I might be depressing your listeners. That's not my intention.
I think we should at least have some thoughts about long-term solutions. The Workers' Party does seem to be very interested in restoring people's ability to make a living, for whatever purpose. But so, come on, let's have a little bit of... Some vision.
Oh, you're talking to the wrong person here for cheer and vision, Tony. No, I'm only kidding. Right, so What can we do? Well, it must start with public investment. We must start with, we stop selling bonds. We could maybe go with fixed interest, low yield bond and say, take them or leave them. And if they leave them, then we'll make up that gap with public investment. We'll nationalize energy. We'll go for cheap energy, maybe thorium salt reactors. China is developing online for 2029. I'll leave it to the engineers to tell me which are the best options. We've got wind power, which we can integrate into the system, a little bit of fossil fuel to back it up, a sensible energy system, reduce the cost of energy. And then we could start reducing the cost of business. We could bring back some judicious manufacturing. We can't make cheap electronic goods like they do in the Far East, but we can make at least some stuff. We should bring steel, major metal manufacturing, because that's a national security issue, and start to invest in new rail networks, nationalize the rail networks, invest in public services, health, education, and also boost aggregate demand to allow small and medium enterprises to give them some customers, so that they're coming to their shops and restaurants and cafes and buy their goods. And maybe start, but that must start with a huge injection of public investment. There's no other way to do it, because private investment is not interested in this country. It's interested in low wage, low cost, low tax environments in which they can maximize the returns on their investment.
Yeah, well, so are there any historical precedents for something like this?
1945.
Yeah, what happened then?
Massive public investment, nationalization. And it was sabotaged in the 1970s. Stagflation was completely unnecessary. Banks started lending out far too much cheap bank credit in the late in the 1960s. OPEC put the oil prices up. We could have given the oil-using industries a 10% subsidy in controlled stagflation. Then Healy, of course, did these dodgy currency swaps in 1976, followed by an IMF loan that was only necessary because of the currency swaps. So the whole thing, I didn't want to go too far down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, but that looked like deliberate sabotage. The bankers wanted to take back control, and the money lenders wanted to take back control of the nation and take back control of the West, of Europe and America too. So the whole New Deal was cancelled. The Great Society was cancelled. The Keynesian welfare state was cancelled. The Soviet Union was starting to stagnate, so they were less worried about people turning to communism than full-blown socialism. So they attacked and they deliberately sabotaged the whole project. And here we are. We ended up, they put the neoliberals in. The neoliberals have been planning this since their meeting in 1938 in Paris, the Walter Lippmann Colloquium, and through the think tanks, you know, the Adam Smith Institute and the Institute of Economic Affairs and the von Mises Institute, all of these things. All of these people were, Hayek and the rest of them were present at that meeting, Milton Friedman present at that meeting in 1938 in Paris. And the idea was to destroy, to sever the link between democracy and the state, because they didn't trust it. They thought it was prone to populism and Nazism and Stalinism and whatever, to sever that link and to put the market in charge, because they thought the market was safer and fairer and more gentle. And it turns out to be an even more brutal master in more subtle and more subtle, widespread and long ways. So it, you know, long standing ways. I mean, so it was a disastrous experiment. It could have been avoided, but we're now in a situation where it's going to be very, very difficult to start pulling things back. The Chinese model gives us some clues about what we can do by using state funded policy banks, huge public investment. Their workers are now, a lot of them working in the care industry, so they're using direct state jobs, funded jobs to pay for elderly care, because they've got an aging population. Their industries are starting to automate now. They're very well advanced in AI and all the rest of it. So they know it's going to put people out of work. So they're employing them in the care industry, huge care and health industry they've got. Don't forget Mao, for all his brutality, which I won't deny, have raised Chinese life expectancy by 30 years, from 35 to 65-year-old in more than a decade, just over a decade. That's an incredible statistic.
Well, I mean, what you're describing with the renationalisation, etc., the government taking back control of the Bank of England, which Gordon Brown and various other people relinquished that control, it just sounds to me like a kind of 1960s, when I was growing up, mixed economy. It's that simple.
Yes, but that mixed economy is now seen as far left. You know, I mean, that's most Chinese economies are mixed. Venezuela is a mixed economy. They've got one party government, so they, you know, they argue that's totalitarian and we don't want that. But it sounds just sensible, social democratic, mixed economic policy.
Well, how come this sensible way forward is just nowhere in sight?
Because that will take a lot of the private creditors' business away from them, and they live on compound interest and returns on investment. They get very, very rich, very, very powerful, and they invest their money in cutting-edge technology, which puts people out of work but makes them very rich. There's the Spotify example of the platform owner as a billionaire, and all the people who contribute their music, most of them anyway, are poverty-stricken, or just doing it for fun. And you have a few megastars just to, you know, the core, but they make their money both like gigs now. They don't, the recordings don't make much money. There was merchandising and live shows are back on, you know, with all this. That's all the showmanship you see with Dua Lipa and all of these pretty girls all prancing around. That's where they make the money. So you've got that, and they'll invest in that, they'll invest. But that's, as you say, it's monopolization. Fewer and fewer people are becoming, you know, rich, and the rest of us are left basically with crumbs from the table.
Yeah,
and that's the way it's going.
Big vested interests in all of this, keeping us ignorant, which annoys me. Well, look, anyway, well, Steve, I know there are one or two, if you could just within the next minute or so wrap up, one or two really good economists we should know about and how listeners can find and follow you.
Yeah, well, I'm on X. I've gone private for the moment because I said some stuff about Venezuela. I was attacked by hundreds of bots, you know, these bot accounts, which with the strange anime cartoon avatars. Now AI is producing what are called conversant bots or conversational bots, where when they say something stupid, you tell them to go forth and multiply, but they come back at you and they keep answering you. It's a bit like talking to Grok or DeepSeek or something like that. So now you're swamped with these bots. And if you say anything controversial, you're just basically buried. And some of them are very abusive and nasty, ad hominem, you know. You add that to the MAGA numpties and the supporters of Machado and all the rest of it, and they pile in as well. So it's very, very difficult.
Look, we've got very little time, so
okay, sorry, this is you'll be able to find me back on X soon when I open my account again. But look at the work of Steve Keen. Michael Hudson, particularly. Some of the modern monetary theory guys are worth a read. Bill Mitchell, some of them less so. But look at any heterodox economist who is going against the grain of orthodox neoclassical economics. Steve Keen, Michael Hudson are the best for me.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, bit of a tour de force there from Steve, and I'll be putting that full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. It's interesting what he's talking about right at the very end there, with him having to turn his Twitter account private, and he starts talking about economics relating to and criminology and the influence of the United States relating to Venezuela. As he told me after we'd finished there, it was, I mean, as he explains a little bit there, that it's a whole like troll farm of people. He thought that some of them looked like people, but then there was also all these AI bots started attacking his Twitter account and everything he'd been saying. So as soon as he replies to them, so then the whole flood of replies come back to him, and the idea is that they're trying to overwhelm you with AI, criticizing every single thing you say.
Well, I mean, that's clearly the way things are going.
This is Elon Musk and his little platform.
That's right,
so-called free speech.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading Moon of Alabama some weeks ago now, and it was because it's, you know, it's a forum where people post and comment on the main articles. And it was obviously an AI was doing something, because as soon as anybody said anything, this AI would come back with a kind of paragraph, two, three paragraphs. That, you know, it obviously wrote them just like that. Yeah. And then, of course, as soon as you say something, they pick up, you know, and this is a way of closing down the debate. Yeah. And of course, they do try to control all of this.
It's accelerationism, actually.
Well, that's right.
It's piling onto you. But it's all sorts of fascinating things he's talking about there. Not least of which, it was obviously a pleasure. I could see you smiling like a Cheshire cat over there when he said, actually, the model is China.
Well, the model isn't necessarily China for us, but basically the
mixed economy that's been very successful.
The mixed economy is the way. It always was the way. What's bizarre about all of this is that we actually knew what to do. When I was learning economics at Oxford University in the 1970s, my tutors were all Keynesians, and everybody was, apart from a few mavericks. And that basically, the Keynesianism is a belief in a mixed economy.
So that means that you've got, was it roughly a 50-50 split in the economy, where the infrastructure of the country is run by the government, not for profit, but profits that are made are ploughed back into taxation and to government spending, and the business community is out there doing more innovative stuff that isn't actually part of the infrastructure. So it's not that they're preventing business, but the idea is to keep business well away from things like infrastructure, gas, electricity, water, transport, things which everybody needs and are natural monopolies.
Well, that's right. And of course, there's some concept in the economics called opportunity cost. If I can make more money by parking my money in a monopoly, which is ripping off the society, I'm not going to invest in things like an innovative small business, which is risky. Why do that? So this has a cumulative effect. If in actual fact the money is to be made by financial manipulation and control, you know, basically controlling markets for, you know, through insider trading and so on, nobody is going to. That's why the innovation dies off in that reality. It's not as if if we get rid of the state, there'll be more innovation. In actual fact, if you get rid of the state, you get less innovation because all the money goes into ripping people off instead of making new stuff.
Becomes a threat.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. Innovation. Well, that's right. So anyone that's innovate, quick, get rid of them. Well, quick, find some way to stop them.
Yeah, I mean, getting the balance right is tricky. Yeah.
He talks about surpluses there, quite, you know, which is one of those basic economic terms. I mean, it seems obvious to me that the surpluses, it's much better, particularly with all this infrastructure and natural monopolies, that surplus is going to the tax man rather than going to shareholders.
That's right, and that means that you don't have to tax workers.
Ooh.
Can you see what the ultimate goal, which we've never achieved, even in the 1940s to 1970s, in the, you know, le temps glorieux, as they call them in France, the 30 good years, we never quite got to where we should be. Where, you know, all speculation and was basically pushed out. There was always going to be a residual kind of speculative part of the economy. But what's happened is it's quite deliberate. They've got rid of what worked because it didn't work for them. And Kaletsky, who is a Polish-British economist in the 1950s, he was Keynesianism became dominant in university economics in that period. Yeah, people like Friedman were regarded as cranks because they are cranks. Actually, I mean, they don't really know what they're on about.
Did you heard about this 1938 meeting he's talking about there in Paris, the Walter Lippmann Colloquium? I think he's
well, I think I'm vaguely aware of it. Very important organisation was the Mount Pelerin Society, which actually met up, I think, I believe, in Switzerland or Austria.
Because it was quite a lot around. I mean, obviously, we have the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of the Second World War too. So it almost seems like the bankers were watching, sitting up on the top of a mountain in Switzerland, maybe, watching the war going on and thinking, we can make a lot of money if we can control the outcome of this war. Well, we can make billions.
Well, the Bretton Woods Conference was a compromise between the, you know, it led to global mixed economy, including in the US. It wasn't entirely. I mean,
they set up the IMF, didn't they? Become an American
tool. That's right.
Really.
I mean, what Keynes was pushing for at Bretton Woods is, why don't we set up a supranational international currency to settle international trade imbalances? We call it Bancor, and it won't be controlled by any individual country. But of course, the Americans said, "Yeah, we like the idea of having some kind of system to try and balance things out, but it's got to be the dollar at the basis of it." So that was, they insisted that the dollar had to be the basis of it. And of course, ultimately, that meant that the Americans were in a position in 1971 to take the dollar off gold and make everybody else pay their debts. If there were any other country that didn't produce the world's reserve currency, they would long ago have had to stop fighting wars in other countries. They'd have had to do all, you know, they'd have just had to cut their coats according to their cloth. But they don't have to, because they make everybody else pay for their war machine, which they then use to invade your country and force you to hand over your assets. And of course, that's exactly what's going on in Venezuela.
Okay, so you've also got this whole idea of markets correcting themselves, although there's a little bit of volatility. So this sounds to me like some sort of wet dream for the banksters, because they know the volatility, they know about, you know, what's about to happen, they were insider dealing the whole time. So the volatility is necessary. So that they have got an opportunity for profit. They will bank on the ones, it's like a massive gamble where they're on the inside. So as the market gets volatile in whatever area, they will make money wherever, whether it goes up or down now.
That's right. Well, I mean, we can see now what's been happening with Argentina, where the Milei, they've just had two 22 billion handouts, the first from the IMF, the next from the US Treasury, so the free market experiment in Argentina, which was going to crash the economy, it hasn't, because they've been given $44 billion worth of public money to underpin their free market experiment. And therefore it looks, and it's not really working anyway. But I mean, what the whole point about this is, as you gradually move towards a speculative, financialized economy, that you could get away with that for years and years and years. But what's now emerging is you've got a Chinese economy with a nationalized banking system, which can't go bust. And you've got a Russian military, which has nationalized production. And it's actually far, far more efficient than the Western military industrial complex, which is good at making money for insiders, but produces rubbish kit, which is no use for anything and can't actually win wars.
Anyway, hopefully we've put together a few ideas for Rachel Reeves. Not that, of course, that she will listen, because she only listens to the livery companies, the City of London, maybe the Order of the Garter, possibly, you know, these sort of city institutions and royal institutions, which there's no kind of feedback, it seems, from the people. Obviously, there should be in a democracy, but it doesn't really seem to be quite happening, does it? So, Martin, what about your thoughts about what she may do and what she should do? I did ask that question to Steve, but I think it's only fair to ask the same question to you.
Well, I think what's going to happen is she's going to try and square the circle of, the thing she must avoid doing, and I don't think she's necessarily going to manage this, is you don't want to be cutting demand out of the economy. Because if you cut demand out of the economy...
If she raises income tax, she's going to be doing
that. That's right. So you don't want to raise taxes on people who are going to spend the money. Yeah. Because if that means they won't go out and spend the money, because they've given it to the government in tax. That's why you've got to tax the wealthy, because they don't spend most of their money.
So is there any way...
Most of the money of the wealthy, they don't spend it.
The obvious thing to do is to somehow increase people's disposable incomes, so they spend a bit more. How is that possible?
Yes, it is, but you've got to redistribute wealth from the wealthy that don't spend money, the marginal propensity to consume, as it used to be, as it was still called in textbooks.
How can you get that money, though? Most of it's offshore, isn't it?
Well, that's where you've got to start thinking, how do we get that money?
You know, it's funny, because in central London a couple of weeks ago, actually in the same trip to London where I met various friends of Mark Saunders, it was interesting going to the Supreme Court, because there's an exhibition in there all about the various territories that Britain owns. And I looked up at this, and in fact I should probably share this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, almost all of the tax havens are there listed. It's just a little list and a little arrow pointing to a map of the world. And there you can see where all the tax havens are. Almost all of them are British.
Yeah, but it's not just British. I mean, British tax havens are important, but they're not the only ones. I mean, Delaware in the US, for example. I mean, Hudson goes on about how they tried to make that, you know, he was actually working for the government at the time in the 60s. He said, well, we want all criminal money in the world to come to the US. And they actually, you know,
they've got a bit of competition from the City of London, haven't they?
Well, that's right. So in other words, the problem is that if you've got competition, you know, tax haven competition, if you start squeezing one tax haven, the the money just goes to another one. Yeah. And in actual fact, the Panama Papers was driven by CIA, in my view. So they were attacking the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and so on, because then wealthy people will have to put their money in Delaware instead. Do you see what I'm getting at there? One way you can deal with this is, instead of taxing profits and wealth, corporations could be taxed on their turnover. So the government could assess, say, Microsoft as a turnover in Britain. Now, what they do is what they call transfer pricing. So the internal prices that Microsoft charges, or any big company, are rigged so that all the profits are shown as if they are in Bermuda, and all and in actual fact, in Britain, they don't show any profits at all. But that's just an accounting trick. What you could do to get round that is, the government assesses how much turnover Microsoft has had in Britain in a year, not their profits, just what they've sold, and you tax that. And they say, well, that we estimate that you've had a turnover of 10 billion, and that's what we're going to tax you on. And they say, but we haven't been, in actual fact, our turnover is much lower than that. And all our, but we don't care about that. We've assessed you at 10 billion, and we're going to give you a bill for that. So that's the way to get corporations to pay their taxes. And then the other thing you've got to do with very wealthy people, if they've stolen their wealth, you can take the money off them because they're criminals. You just put them in prison and take the money because you're a criminal.
44% of our income is going on rents now, which is an absolutely colossal amount. But there is a little bit of good news this week about the no-fault evictions being ended. Now, obviously, there's been for years now an increase every year in the number of evictions, but this is the Labour Party's answer to try and stop that. Six housing changes for the UK renters, including eviction ban and rules over pets. The Act sees the abolition of Section 21 no-fault evictions. That's now received the Royal Assent. The government's Renters' Rights Bill got the Royal Assent this week, affording England's 11 million renters more rights. And that Act sees the abolition of this no-fault eviction idea. I mean, that is one way, I suppose, to let's push thousands of people into homelessness. That's one way, I suppose. But, of course, this is going to affect buy-to-let landlords are going to be thinking, well, if I can't actually get rid of people when I need to and I want to sell the place or whatever, then I'm afraid I'm going to just have to stop doing this. And they will probably sell their home to Lloyds Bank or one of the big financial institutions. So, again, this is a family business, right or wrong, that is being taken over by these big monopolies. So let's just look at the changes for a minute here. The no-fault evictions, landlords will need a very good reason to evict you moving forward. So if there's no fault eviction, if there's no fault by you, it's very difficult to evict you, although if they are selling the place, I imagine they still can. They can be still evicted on a Section 21 notice between now and when the law comes into force next year. So this isn't really quite in effect yet, even though it's law. Landlords will not be able to ask for more than 1 month's rent in advance, which is a lot of them have been doing. Fixed term tenancies between 6 and 24 months will be banned. So you will have a permanent tenancy. So it's not as if it's going to be up for review every 6 months. And if they don't like you, they can get rid of it. Landlords will be forced to consider requests for pets. They will no longer be able to unreasonably refuse pets. That sounds a sort of, you know, it's obviously quite important for some people. And there's a common practice of people bidding above the asking price to secure a rental property. So the rental bidding wars will no longer be allowed. This will be banned. Landlords and estate agents will be forced to publish an asking price for a property. And it will also be illegal for landlords and estate agents to discriminate against people who are on benefits. Now, some great changes here, but actually the superstructure of overpriced housing is not going away.
No, it's not. And I'm very worried about this personally because of my personal situation. What I fear will happen is that because it hasn't been introduced straight away, bang, it's not coming until next year. Anybody that they want to get rid of, they're going to get rid of them now. Yeah, that's what's going to happen. And of course, the other thing,
they might use that just as an excuse to put the rent up.
That's right. There's all sorts of things they can do. There's ways round it, if you follow me. What we really need is low cost council housing, which is what we used to have. We used to have loads of it. And it actually meant that the private landlords were on the back foot because people had an alternative and they could just go and get a council house. And well, of course, we got rid of that, and that's why we're all stuck in private rented, because that was the plan.
I rather like the idea of people having their own homes and not necessarily swanky, expensive ones either. And I was really, really so happy to run into this guy called Stefan Selken. He's written a couple of books about something called the plot lands. Now, before we hear from him, have you ever heard about these, Martin? In the 1920s and 1930s, people would buy up or sometimes rent a field in a nice, desirable area. And in those days, you could just sell or rent out or lease chunks of the field out, and people would build what were almost like kind of English datchers. So they were initially they were places that people would go in the summer, and quite often they would sell and get or get rid of or just move out of a rented house in a city and move to their hut on one of these plot lands from the 1920s and 1930s. I mean, it just sounds like an amazing idea, but of course that was all stopped after the Second World War with the Town and Country Planning Act, so that you would have to have planning permission to do anything like that. But anyway, this sounds to me like a great little solution, actually almost on the Russian dacha model, Martin.
Well, I mean, it might be part of a solution, but as you pointed out, it depends upon what the regulations are. And of course, what we really need is a variety of different things, options for people on low incomes. You know, you could let people build. I mean, we've had in Bristol, we've had people build their own houses, haven't we? Because I remember we had I can't remember the name of the Labour councillor for Fish Ponds. Because she was involved in, you know, they let people, you know, self-build, you know, you arrange to do it, and then you get permission, and then you can do it. That's all very well, but what we really need is what we used to have, which is, I mean, when I lived in London in the 1980s, they used to have even what they were called hard to let properties in tower blocks in the inner city. But and people could actually, there was actually an excess of housing, so that you could get on the list and get a council flat as a hard to let flat. You can't.
They'd actually built enough houses for everyone in the 1970s.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So you've actually reached a point where there's actually a surplus of low cost housing, and then of course the landlords and the exploiters are not in a position to do anything. They're marginalised.
In fact, people would be moving out and saying, sorry, this is rent's too expensive.
That's right.
We're going to a
exactly
council
so,
place.
But the whole point of all of this is what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England. The property owners and the big property owners.
Then it's not their fault that they happen to be born in the southeast.
No,
is
no
it?
But the point is, if you inherit property in the southeast, which some people do, that is just free money forever, and it distorts.
Well, that's not those people's fault, though, is it?
No.
Many of these homes were bought for like £1,000, £2,000.
Well, you could argue that nobody should have more than one house at all.
Yeah,
you could make a rule that say if you've got, you know, nobody should have two houses until everybody's got one house. That was, in fact, the kind of principle
that
was being operated.
But the thing is, we're in a very different world now because we've got something like 10 million extra people to house here in Britain. Anyway, having a chat to Stefan about the plot lands in the 1920s and 30s, he's written a couple of books on these. And it just shows you that back in those days, people were thinking outside the box a bit. They were thinking, well, I could just buy a little bit of land for a few £100 out in somewhere a bit nicer, maybe a little bit outside London or in another part of the country, maybe in Wales. There's quite a lot up in the north of England and in the West Country as well. I could just buy this place. And then they used to go backwards and forwards, and then they would slowly but surely build themselves a little hut. And but this was all stopped. Anyway, so here's Stefan Selken now. He's written a couple of books on this, and I'll put a longer version of this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
From the 20s and 30s, it grew as an alternative to what was then, but the 1947 Planning Act kind of brought it to a close, really, and all that campaigning by people like Clough Williams Ellis had the result of having that 1947 Planning Act was very much used to close down plotland development. But yeah, plotlands can be separated from the kind of back to the land movements previously to that. In that, I mean, you know, it was, I don't know, less organized, maybe more people individually buying plots, you know, and landowners selling or renting off smaller than you were saying, you know, really quite small, big enough just for the house and a garden, plots of land by rivers, by the sea, anywhere that cheap land was and that they could get rid of, that they wanted to get rid of and get some money for.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see this Town and Country Planning Act after World War II in this context of really, you know, you could even say hundreds of years of attempts by people to get a bit of land back after the enclosures. You know, this idea that you're going to be a landless person, you've got to go around to the capitalist begging for a job. You know, they decided, no, we want out of that. A little bit like any kind of counterculture that there's been in this country for the last 50 years.
You can trace this back right the way down to when people used to build their own houses because nobody else was going to build them for them. They just built their own houses. That was the vernacular of, and Britain was particularly rich because it's just got such a varied geology that every sort of, you know, every 50 miles, there's a completely different form of vernacular architecture. So there is a connection right back to that. And it's more like the industrial working class finding out because of the use of the railways that they could get out of the cities and build places for themselves. Yeah. Again. So it was a reconnection with that kind of original, thing that's all over the world. People just, it's natural, as it were, not, it's a basic cultural fact that people will have the skills to build their own dwellings.
So when were most of the plot lands built and how many are there?
Well, like I said, it was between the 20s and 30s that they were particularly active and they gradually accrued services. The good thing about the plotlands is not only is it improvised, but it grows with the family or whatever, or it grows with resources. So somebody might start off in Shepperton. I've got records of them starting off with tents and then gradually getting a shed and getting, you know, and then they get a standpipe they can use and the sheds get extra bedrooms. But it's a form of housing that can grow with a family or grow with people as they have extra bits of money. They kind of add another room on or redo the roof or something like that.
I mean, Britain seems to be, I don't know how unique it is, but it seems to be that there's really no, apart from the super mega rich, nobody builds their own home here. Nobody designs their own home. You just have to take what you're given here.
Well, there is a self, I don't want to contradict you particularly, but there is a self-build movement. But what's happened to that is it's very much within the mortgage houses type frame, you know, since 1947. And people build conventional brick and houses that they owe money on, so they owe mortgages on. But if they've got the skills, they do it themselves. So there always has been a small number of self-build people. And in fact, I'm one of them because I was one of 10 families built 10 houses just behind Kennington Tube in 1993 to 96, organised by a housing association. But we kind of got our hands dirty, got bruised thumbs and things like that.
So that's Stefan Selkun, spelt S-Z-C-E-L-K-U-N. And Stefan with an F, S-T-E-F-A-N, talking about the plotlands. And, I mean, he's done a book about the Shepperton plotlands, which is an absolutely beautiful book. And you can see this is all prime real estate places along the side of the River Thames. But you know what? They're not posh houses. They're not mansions. They're huts.
Well, it's great that these things did exist and still exist to some extent.
Yeah, in fact, some of them are challenged.
The bigger questions are to do with the way that the housing market works in Britain, because it's not just about housing. What it leads to is a tendency towards inflation caused by prices rising for housing. And that then leads to having to raise interest rates to control the inflation, which then smashes your small and medium enterprise sector, which is why we've been deindustrialised. What's happened in the southeast of England is we've got loads and loads of conservatories and loft conversions, but we haven't got the little machine tool factories that we used to have in the East Midlands. They've gone.
Yeah, so it just seems to me brilliant that people have just decided, well, I'm just going to buy a little bit of land and build a little hut on it and maybe an extra couple of bedrooms to accommodate the rest of the family, build their own places. The interesting thing, though, it was actually the Labour government in 1947 that stopped it all and said, no, we're going to build council houses and people are going to have to live in those. You can't build your own places. Now, of course, the whole council house thing got thrown out of the window in the 1970s and the 80s with Thatcher. And so now there's nothing.
Well, that's right. There's nothing. And, of course, you can't just let people build anything they want anywhere. You know, I mean, if Ireland is a lovely country, and I used to go there a lot, but they've got very lax planning laws, and so you end up with all sorts of things that you're not really
appropriate. Well, we have in this country now, actually.
Well, there's all sorts.
You know, for Persimmon Homes, they can buy a piece of land and build almost anywhere they feel is a useful place to build these days. Yeah. But if you or I wanted to buy a little plot of land, you know, a garden-sized plot of land, no chance, mate.
Well, I mean, they're pushing... The current Labour government is in the pocket of the house developers because they've given them loads of money and they see it. You see, this is how lame-brained it is. They just see getting the housing market going as the solution to Britain's problems. And, of course, it isn't. All these houses that are being built, if they are going to be built, will have no effect whatsoever on low-income people because they can't buy them. Yeah, if we're trying to solve the housing problem for low-income people, just building houses ain't going to do it. And, of course, there's plenty of empty houses in Britain and plenty of big houses with lots of room in them. Yeah, but they're privately owned and nobody poor is allowed to go anywhere near
them. Actually, what happens is a lot of them are just used as investments by foreigners too. Right. I mean, here in Bristol, we've got that big tower, massive tower that's just built next to Castle Park. In fact, there's two now, aren't there? There's a big square one. And then there's a kind of oval-shaped one. And I was walking past there the other evening, and I'm looking up, and there's only about two or three lights in any of the flats. There's hundreds of flats up there. Yep. But these are all being bought as investments, and yet there's nobody living in. Maybe we should go and squat one.
Well, you're not allowed to.
Well, we're always told that. Yeah, actually, I think you probably have to be rather good at rock climbing or something in order to get up there. But you're probably not going to be able to go through the stairwell. But, I mean, the point is, this is appalling waste of housing, actually, that's going on right now.
Well, if we really were at war with Russia and, you know, there was a blockade on Britain by Russian submarines and so on, maybe somebody filled with clipboards would have to go around saying we're going to requisition all of these properties and we're going to put people in them, because that's what you have to do in wartime.
Anyway, it's not going to be Rachel Reeves that changes any of this. You know who it's going to be? It'll be Nigel Farage and Reform. They're the ones that are looming on the horizon.
Are they going to change
any
of this?
To do all this? Well, maybe they will, maybe they won't, maybe they won't. But anyway, we heard some quite a big story this week about the Reform Party saying, I think, is it Sarah Potchin, one of their councillors or MPs?
She's an MP for Runcorn.
Yeah, talking about the over-propensity, as she sees it, of blacks and Asians in our TV ads.
Sir Keir Starmer has called a Reform UK MP racist after she complained that adverts were full of black and Asian people. Sarah Potchin, who represents Runcorn and Helsby, apologised for the remarks made during a programme on Talk TV on Saturday, saying they were phrased poorly, but she maintained that many adverts were unrepresentative of British society. Reform's leader Nigel Farage called the comments ugly and clumsy, but insisted he didn't believe them to have racist intent. More from our political correspondent Harry Farley.
Sarah Potchin became one of Nigel Farage's MPs in May, having won her seat by just 6 votes. An outspoken figure in Reform UK, on a Talk TV show this weekend, she agreed with a caller who had concerns about the demographics of TV adverts.
It drives me mad when I see adverts full of black people, full of Asian people, full of, you know, people that basically are anything.
What's wrong with that, Sarah? What's wrong with that?
Well, it doesn't reflect our society.
Ms. Potchin quickly apologised, saying her comments were phrased poorly and that she hadn't meant to cause offence. She went on to cite a recent study for Channel 4 News that found around half of adverts since 2022 have featured a black person. But she's been condemned by the Prime Minister.
It's shocking racism, and it's the sort of thing that will tear our country apart, and it tells you everything about Reform. And Nigel Farage has got some questions to answer, because either he doesn't consider it racist, which in my view is shocking in itself, or he does think it's racist, and he's shown absolutely no leadership.
In a news conference in Westminster this afternoon, I asked Nigel Farage if he thought Ms. Potchin's remarks were racist and whether he would take any disciplinary action.
I understand the basic point, but the way she put it, the way she worded it, was wrong and was ugly. And if I thought that the intention behind it was racist, then I would have taken a lot more action than I have to date. And that is because I don't.
In many ways, this row is a snapshot of our politics at the moment. Labour escalating its battle to define itself against reform in the hope it can lead an alliance against the insurgent party, and Nigel Farage needing to keep his party together while trying not to alienate those considering whether to support him.
So the question is the comments saying that adverts are full of black and Asian people nowadays, is it racist?
Well, I think if we're going to have freedom of speech, those who think it's racist can call it racist, and those who don't will say it isn't.
Is it or not?
In my view, it is, but then Nigel Farage's view is isn't. It's freedom of speech, isn't it?
Is it a fact or not?
Is what a fact?
Is it, you know, well, you know what I'm saying, don't you? If adverts are full of black and Asian people.
Well, the adverts are full of black and Asian people because the private companies that pay for those adverts wanted those people to...
You just said it yourself. You're a racist.
As far as I'm concerned, she is a racist. I think
lots. So are you, if you've just repeated what she said.
Well, I'm just repeating it because I'm just repeating what she said.
All right. Look, I'm being sort of provocative here. But I mean, it's certainly this actually what's going on within advertising is this thing called positive discrimination, isn't it?
No, it's not discrimination. It's the people in advertising. They get their money from selling stuff. And if they choose to put black faces on there, they're not selling stuff. If you remember when we were kids, there was hardly a black face in any adverts at all, was there? They just weren't there. Now, the reason why private companies are putting black faces in their adverts is because they're trying to sell stuff. And if they weren't selling stuff, they wouldn't do it. It's called the free market, Tony. Yeah, and it's a free market, and she could say, I don't like it. But in actual fact, she hasn't got the power to tell private companies what they do with their advertising, because they're private. They're not controlled by the government. They're not controlled by her. And if they want to put black faces on those adverts, she can always turn the channel, or she doesn't have to buy the three-piece suite that they're selling. That's capitalism.
It's actually not, though, is it? Because the Advertising Standards Authority actually does have guidelines that encourage the use of black and Asian people.
Yes, that may be there, but it's not. It's encouragement. There's plenty of adverts which don't have black and Asian people in. Yeah. Are they forced to put black and Asian people in their adverts? Well, they're not.
Well, yes, they are, because they're told you must have this quota of black and Asian people in your adverts, apparently. This is the Advertising Standards Authority. I mean, this is kind of they're a bit like Ofcom regulates the broadcasters, but the ads are regulated by ASA.
Well, I would suggest that underlying all of this is the desire for profits by those who make adverts. And that's the truth.
Well, that's true, but then the thing is that they might not be if they have not enough black and Asian people on those adverts, they might not be making profit for very long because the Advertising Standards Authority will be on their backs.
Okay, well, we could just say we won't have an Advertising Standards Authority altogether. And
they're
that
actually quite
the
good. Once or twice, I've written to them over misleading claims in adverts,
yeah.
And they write back to you and they say, "We've had a look at your claim and we have demanded this advert be withdrawn." This sort of thing. So they're actually quite good, dear.
Well, in other words, like most markets, there is a
better
degree
than Ofcom, I would say.
A degree of regulation.
So, for example, if a broadcaster is unbalanced or puts out complete misinformation, you could write to Ofcom and they just ignore you, whereas the ASA do tend to write back.
Yeah. So, in other words, we're working within this kind of, you know, managed free market, if you like. I mean, the point about there's more black and Asian people on TV programmes than there are in the general population is because that, you know, if you've got to have, you know, if you have to have it just as in the general population, you wouldn't probably have any at all. I mean, when I was a kid, you hardly ever saw a black face in a TV advert, ever.
Things have moved on.
Well, things have moved on, but she doesn't like it.
Anyway, the fact is it racist or not? This is the question.
I think people are going to accuse reform of being racist, whether they say they're not. I say they are. That's my freedom of speech. They support Israel, as does Keir Starmer. Everybody who supports Israel is supporting genocide. That is racist.
Stick to this story for a second. What she says, they're full of black and Asians. Well, they're not full of black and Asians, really. So it's not stating facts. So, you know, she's exaggerating that. But she's trying to make a point, and I think Farage is actually right. She didn't make it very well. But anyway, reform is supposedly our political future, so it's all good idea to keep an eye on what they're up to. And this week we had a guy called Dr. David Bull, who is, do you know, is he an MP? I don't know, but he's a reform character who he held something, and they're copying the Americans, aren't they, funnily enough? You know, the US have these town hall events. Well, they had a town hall event this week in London, and David Bull was hosting it, but he was also chatting with a reform councillor for Westminster, because they have quite a few in the Westminster borough running Westminster. So her name is Layla Cunningham. So let's have a little listen to an excerpt from Reform's town hall this week in central London.
I have a woman who's a resident, she's a bus driver. She cries to me and she says, you know, I've been a bus driver for 20 years. I'm so tired. I can't take a holiday. She says, but the person, she says, I get no help because she's just above that threshold for work where she doesn't really get help with her rent. And but you know, she says, that just means I'll work harder. Mm. And that is a British value. But she says, the person next door has just arrived, doesn't speak English, got a three-bedroom flat for free.
So that's really interesting. As I go around the country, I keep saying that is what people are telling me. It doesn't matter where I am in the country. This is about fairness, or the lack of fairness in this country. And that is what is so upsetting to British people, which is actually they are not being looked after properly. We are not putting British people first, and we need to do that and do it urgently.
It's about respect. It's respecting the people that built this country. It's respecting the people that built this city. And the political class doesn't respect that anymore. And I don't feel that they prioritise us. And that's why I joined Reform, because I feel there is a really strong priority. We're not ashamed to be patriotic, but the political class have made it shameful to love your country, shameful to have family values. And that has to be reversed, because...
One of the other things that I keep saying is actually we're a relatively small party. You know, we have five members of parliament, two marvellous mayors and so on. We also have 265,000 members as of today, so I'm delighted by that. But it's amazing, isn't it? We're on the front page of every single national newspaper almost every single day.
Yes.
And I think the reason for that is we are not afraid to say things that the rest of the political establishment simply will not say. But it is what people are saying in the pubs, they're saying it in social clubs, they're saying it all over the streets, the towns, the villages.
And in those towns and villages, they've seen some of their towns and villages change. Mm. It's become unrecognisable. And I get sometimes... I was speaking at an event and the person... Someone said, oh, you know, they were talking about Islam and how it's a problem. And someone said, oh, it's a cult. And there was kind of an uncomfortable moment because I'm Muslim. But there are Muslim communities that come to this country and expect the country to change for them.
Yes.
And if the country doesn't change for them, they say you're racist. But there is nothing racist about wanting to protect your values, your way of life in this country. That's patriotism. And that's something that I believe Reform stands for and other political parties have not.
So does that make you... So does that help you? Because you can actually say, I am Muslim, I can't possibly be being racist. Does that help you in your arguments when certainly the broadcasters will level accusations at you?
Yeah.
They would certainly level at me or many of our MPs, for example.
Oh, they still level it. But because they will, no matter what you do, you could get, you know, it doesn't really matter who you are. But there's nothing racist about wanting to preserve your way of life. There's nothing racist about loving Britain and wanting to preserve British way of life. And it is, I think if you went to any country and you can't rock up to a country and say, I want it to change, and the people say, okay, we're tolerant, but we're not suckers.
So that's Layla Cunningham. I didn't realise, actually, she says in there she was Muslim as well. You know, what we've got here, Martin, is this bizarre situation where the bus driver who's complaining that someone's got a three-bedroom flat next door, black and Asians, too many on TV, people saying Islam is a cult. These people are just blaming the individuals who are here. Well, actually, this is a massive structural thing, immigration, isn't it? And the people who are responsible for it never really seem to get in the focus of the ire of the Reform people at all.
Well, also, I mean, when they were saying, it struck me, he was saying we're on the front page of the newspapers every day, and that's because the newspapers are run by the Tory press are pushing Reform. You know,
and what about David
Tories? The Tories are finished now, so the Daily Mail and the Daily Express are pushing Reform's agenda
every day. Murdoch
is pushing their agenda every day.
The guy you just heard from there, David Bull, he's someone who came from nowhere with the sort of magic wand of Rupert Murdoch, was turned into a talk TV presenter. He's been named as Reform UK's new chairman, who replaced Zia Yusuf. So he's come along a sort of very fast escalator up from nobody into a TV studio, and now he's chairman of Reform.
Yes, and of course we know that billionaires, foreign billionaires...
This is a Murdoch channel, isn't
it? Yes, I know, but foreign billionaires, Elon Musk and all the others, are pouring money in to turn, you know, what used to be, you know, minor thugs like Tommy Robinson into, I bet you he's pushing out being a millionaire now because he's basically made a life for himself.
Yeah. So we'll be hearing a bit about Tommy Robinson, because this seems to be one of the major aspects of Reform UK, is they're a so-called anti-racist respectable party, but they have this kind of quiet arm round the Tommy Robinson Brigade, who most definitely are racist and violent thugs.
Yes, well, it's going to be a problem for them
this from many years ago, you know. Isn't it? Something called the SA, remember them?
The SA in Germany.
In Nazi Germany in the 1930s. They were a bunch of street-fighting thugs, exactly like Farage's bunch.
Well, I think what you've got in both Britain and the United States is the respectable face of racism, if you like, let's call it that, and then you've got the unrespectable face, but they're working both sides of the park.
Isn't it a little bit like, say, for example, in the Irish Troubles, Sinn Féin and IRA? Sinn Féin are respectable, but actually they've got quite a lot of pals in this other organisation called IRA with bombs and guns.
Well, I suppose you could...
it's the opposite side of politics.
You could say, yes, but I mean, that is what goes on. I mean, it's very clear that there's been a massive increase in racist attacks in this country since all of this kicked off, 2 years ago. You know, there's been a huge increase in attacks on Muslims, for example. The police have the stats, and that's actually just the tip of the iceberg. And anecdotally, because they can talk anecdotes, you know, my bus driver says blah-de-blah-de-blah. That's not necessarily factual, is it? It's just what they're saying. But anecdotally, lots of people from ethnic minorities are saying that they're experiencing much greater hostility than they used to. You know, things had calmed down compared to the 1970s. It was pretty intense. And then everything calmed down, and now I'm afraid it's coming back up again. And when we were protesting against the Bristol Patriots the other week, I was saying to them, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you might end up in Belfast or Bosnia, and you need to go and have a look and see what that looks like. Bristol could be like that. Is that what you want?
On this theme, a friend of this show, Maz Salim, and our thoughts and prayers have been with her this week. She's very, very ill. Her father was killed, I think it was in 2017, in an unprovoked racist attack. He was an elderly mosque goer in Birmingham. And the guy that... This was a story we went into quite deeply at the time, Martin. I don't know if you remember. But the guy that killed him was a guy called Pavlo Lapshin, and he'd been brought to Britain by MI6. He was a Ukrainian Nazi.
That's right, and he went around killing Muslims. He's Ukrainian. So he's defending us. This Ukrainian guy is defending us against British citizens who happen to be Muslim, even though he is in fact Ukrainian, and probably he should be dying on the front line in the Ukraine. What's he doing here?
Anyway, I've missed this story, and thank you. God bless all of our listeners who send me little bits and pieces in. This is from 2 weeks ago now, so not this week, last week. An inquest has opened after the racist murderer dies in prison. An inquest has opened into the death of a man in prison who was jailed for killing 82-year-old in a racist attack and plotting to bomb mosques. Pavlo Lapshin died at HMP Wakefield on the 23rd of September. An inquest has been opened and adjourned in the Coroner's Court in Wakefield and Leeds on Friday. A date has not been yet set for the full inquest, and the prison service said prisons and probation ombudsman would also investigate, as is routine for deaths in custody. The 37-year-old Ukrainian student was serving a life sentence after admitting stabbing Mohammed Salim in Small Heath, Birmingham in 2013, plotting explosions near mosques in Walsall, Tipton and Wolverhampton. Now, what's not mentioned, of course, in this piece here at the BBC about the inquest into the murder or maybe death in prison of Pavlo Lapshin is this MI6 connection.
Well, that's right. And of
he was given a medal at the Foreign Office. And that's why one of the reasons he was brought to Britain. We're going to give you a gift of British citizenship. And we know this is what the spooks do. They offer them a British passport. That's exactly what they did for Pavlo. Well, and then what did he do? He went to Birmingham and murdered an elderly Muslim man.
That's right. And of course, we, Britain's MI6, is very, very heavily involved in the promotion both of Nazi ideology in the Ukraine and extremist Muslim ideology in places like Syria. Al-Qaeda was created by Margaret Thatcher. The name Al-Qaeda was thought up by MI6. Now, does the MP for Runcorn know that? That in actual fact, no. And of course, people who listen to this show will know that we suspect that MI6 are behind most of the so-called Muslim atrocities, like the Manchester Arena bombing carried out
7/7 by London bombing.
Yes, that's right. And of course, as we go forward into this next period, we are going to have to metaphorically beat these people over the head. You do realise that the extremist Muslims and the extremist Ukrainians are paid for by your taxes. Jalani, who is now in power in Syria, has been put in power by your taxes. I haven't been able to see a dentist in 10 years because I can't afford it and the NHS isn't doing anything for me. But money can be spent to put Al-Qaeda in power in Syria. People need to think about that.
Well, it can also be spent on Storm Shadow missiles for Zelensky.
Well, they can, that's right.
To fire into Russia. Anyway, look, on this migration problem, it's fascinating to sometimes to go back to talk to some of the heroes of bygone era. In the mid-1990s in Nicaragua, there was a bloodbath over there and the Americans had been interfering immensely. And one of the people who talked about it is this guy called John Stockwell. And he, as far as I know, he was a colonel and a CIA in the CIA. And he was one of the, I think he's, I'm trying to remember the name of any of his books, Martin, if you can. They were brilliant. I remember at the time getting hold of one of them and finding it absolutely unputdownable. This, they really get up to this and this and this to overthrow a government. And these are the covert operations going on in Africa and mostly and in Central and South America. Stockwell was involved in these things. I know what it was called. In Search of Enemies. Yeah. Fantastic book.
And there was another one called The Praetorians. Was that him as well?
Not sure. Yeah. But anyway, let's have a listen to John Stockwell now talking about this whole idea of let's bring whole loads of people from outside the country in and then we can start a war. We give them guns, we give them bombs and off we go.
We've set out to overthrow functioning constitutional democracies in over 20 countries. We manipulated elections in dozens of countries. We created standing armies and directed them to fight. We went after to organize ethnic minorities to encourage them to revolt. The first thing we did in Nicaragua was to go to the Mosquito Indians, who had never gotten along with the other people in Nicaragua very well, and give them more money than they had seen in the entirety of history, and arms and training and rationales and sanctuaries in Honduras, and sent them into Nicaragua to attack, kill, fight, rape, burn, pillage. And this is an insidious thing. Every society is torn with racial conflicts and conflicts with minorities. Think how violent our nation is. Think what if there were a superpower so big that we didn't dare even flat back or strike back at them, that were coming to our minorities with huge sums of money and arms and training people from our minority groups and sending them into the country to do open acts of violence. How we would rise up and the bloodbath that would ensue. And this has been a technique the CIA has used in Nicaragua, in Thailand, in Vietnam, in Laos, in the Congo, in Iran, Iraq with the Kurds, in different parts of the world. We created, trained, and funded death squads like the Treasury Police in El Salvador that are responsible for killing as many as 70,000 people, according to the count of the Catholic Church. And we've assassinated world leaders, including the United States president in 1963, and I'll get to that in more detail in just a moment. Getting back to the subject of democracy, since that's something that Bush and everyone is talking about right now, I remind you of Chile. In 1973, the CIA organized the overthrow of Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile. And he was killed in the process, and we killed General Schneider, who was the pro-U.S. defender of the Constitution there, in order to put the CIA's representative Pinochet in power. And Henry Kissinger's, when he was grilled by the Congress over this program, his rationale was, yes, the issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves.
So John Stockwell, it is sort of his bestseller, actually, from the 1980s, I think. That talk was in the 1990s. But quite clearly, Martin, these ideas of racial tensions are used to spark civil war. And actually, in a way, it's not really a civil war, is it? It's the CIA's war that they have created.
Well, that's right. And of course, he's got a list there, which was, relevant at the time he was giving it. But of course, they haven't stopped at all since then. What's going on now in Colombia, in Venezuela, I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia, and of course they manipulated
all of these things. I'm sort of trying to focus on Britain, because it certainly seems as if this Lapshin guy was brought deliberately in by MI6 to attack, and in this case kill, Muslims and blow up mosques.
I think probably he was freelancing when he did that, but nevertheless we brought him here and we paid for him to come.
Where did he get the explosives from then, for example?
Well, I don't know, Tony. All of these things need to be properly
investigated. They certainly do. And it seems to me the whole point of somebody like Lapshin, this is why I'm so fascinated by the character, is that, you need something like this to create a backlash by Muslims against these racists. And obviously, Tommy Robinson is out there with his thugs. The idea is we need to provoke a backlash against this. This is how these things are sparked off and started. I find it absolutely shocking and appalling that the authorities in this country, particularly the police and the Home Office, seem to totally ignore this far-right terrorism, effectively. That's what it is.
Well, as I said last week on this show, the special demonstration squad were infiltrating all these left-wing groups and environmental groups, but they didn't bother to infiltrate the right at all until the Workers' Revolutionary Party told one of the police officers that were infiltrating them, we want you to infiltrate the National Front. And that's the first time that the police had infiltrated the National Front at all. And, of course, the UVF and the UDA in Northern Ireland, the two paramilitaries on the loyalist side, the head of the UDA's intelligence operation, Brian Nelson, was a British agent. And so far, that wasn't the British infiltrating, directing them.
So was steak knife. So both sides, yes, of the chessboard. I'd rather like listening to Neil Oliver from time to time. And he is definitely picking up on the sort of stuff we've just been talking about. He is saying this country is being deliberately demolished, and the migrant crisis that we're facing is something which is completely deliberate and all by design. So let's not blame the migrants. Let's stop the people who are trying to make it all happen. That is to say, I don't think Neil Oliver's talking about MI6, but I certainly am.
By now, I realise that what I find most exhausting of all, / most frustrating, / most infuriating, is listening to political types sit or stand in front of us and blame the unmistakable destruction of our country unfolding all around us on nothing more than mistakes and incompetence by the other side. As if there is another side in this world of the uniparty, matching multiple cheeks of the same bottom. To listen to them in Britain, for example, you'd think, for example, that the mass immigration of fighting age men into cities, towns and villages up and down the country was on account of someone's mistake, the consequence of having the wrong people in the relevant jobs. We're invited to think the people in charge right now have lost control of the borders. We're told the hundreds of strangers arrive on our shores every day, for years now, only because someone somewhere isn't doing their job properly. We're also told France is welching on the deal to help stop the little boats. Not so little boats, by the way. And that despite us sending the French government tens of millions of pounds as payment for their end of the deal, that they just won't do their part properly. Curse those pesky French and their incompetent ways. This is a perfect example of what I mean. What makes me so exhausted, / frustrated, / infuriated? For those not in on the trick, here it is. I say the borders are fully under control, as under control as always, just that they're under control by people who want thousands of people to arrive rather than to keep them out. France is also playing its agreed role. I say it's obvious that the borders have been deliberately opened and that large numbers of new people are being brought into Britain to change the makeup of the population. I say it's that simple. No one in authority has lost control of anything, apart from their integrity and morality, obviously. Nothing that is happening by accident or on account of anyone's incompetence. Far, far from it. On the side, some more tens of millions of pounds hoovered up from British taxpayers are sent out of the country, allegedly to pay the French, but as I see it, they might as well just flush them down the toilet because the effect is the same. I say that's just another part of the plan, a bit like a sweetener, and also part of the bigger, ongoing, round-the-clock effort to take as much money as possible from people working here, stop them having it, and send it anywhere and everywhere instead. Chancellor Rachel Reeves will shortly announce how she's going to take even more money from people. She'll say she's dealing with mistakes made before her time in the job. She'll say it's about tightening belts to face an increasingly challenging economic reality. Her political opponents will rant and rave regardless and insist we, the people, would have more money in our pockets if they were in charge. I say their words are meaningless because the intention, arguably not their intention, but the intention of those making real decisions, is to make people poor and so dependent on the state, softened up for Agenda 2030 and feudal digital slavery. Communities in Britain are shocked and appalled. They are especially appalled by the consequences of mass immigration, murders here, rapes there, and no one doing a damn thing about it. I read online this morning about community concerns in Inverness, in the far north of Scotland, about the news 300 asylum seekers are to be placed in an army barracks in the city. But the disruption, anywhere and everywhere, the sowing of racial and religious hate on all sides, I insist that none of it is taking anyone in authority by surprise. On the contrary, I say, I've said before and I will again and again, that there is no incompetence here, that no mistakes are being made, no one dropping the ball in the Home Office or anywhere else. This is happening to plan, to order, because, I say, Britain, the West in general, is being demolished, a controlled demolition. No mistakes, no incompetence, just the careful execution of a plan laid long ago and only now coming to fruition.
Sounds like Neil Oliver is sort of picking up on some of this whole accelerationist idea. Anyway, what do you make of that, Martin?
Well, I think there are objectively reasons why people are moving around the world. It's not just that the government here is encouraging migration from people to come here. I think that's an exaggeration. I think the reality is we shouldn't have overthrown Gaddafi, but we did, and that opened the floodgates to a massive. I've just been reading about the criminal enterprise in Libya. It's now becoming a gateway to Europe, so that they can get into. Italy, they can get, of course, we wrecked Syria. We were just talking about that. Loads of people fled from Syria to Turkey. Then they came to Greece. And of course, eventually they end up on our shores. But of course, the real flood of people coming in is in Greece, in Spain, and in Italy. And of course, in France, they've got more asylum seekers per head than we have. We have one of the lowest in Europe because we're further away. It takes them a long time to get here. Now, we shouldn't have smashed the whole of the Middle East up. We did it. Yeah? British soldiers went to Iraq and trashed the place. They went to Afghanistan and trashed the place. And supposedly, that was to settle it all down and so they could have democracy. But that's not what happened, is it? In actual fact, all of those countries have been turned into wastelands. And of course, people run away. They ran away in Yugoslavia. They didn't have black faces, but when somebody's coming to kill your family, you run away.
And what do you think the people of the Middle East think about the idea of Tony Blair running the Gaza Strip?
Well, it's insult to injury, isn't it? What a disgrace.
There are 66 books in the Bible, 1,189 chapters, 31,101 verses. There are 1,260 promises. There are over 8,000 predictions. There are 6,468 commands. The Bible's been translated into over 1,200 languages. The shortest verse in the Bible is just two words long. It's John chapter 11, verse 35. Jesus wept. There are a lot of tears in the Bible. And here are the Swan Silver Tones telling Mary not to cry with their great song from the VJ record label, Oh Mary, Don't You Weep.
I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Martha, don't have to mourn.
Oh, Martha, don't you mourn.
Listen to me, Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Martha, don't have to mourn.
Oh, Martha, don't you mourn.
Pharaoh's army,
oh, Mary, don't you weep.
They got drowned in the sea one day. But Jesus said, Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Your little sister don't have to mourn,
oh,
no more.
Mother, don't you mourn.
Now can I get a witness? He said, Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Mother don't have to mourn.
Oh, Mother, don't you mourn.
It may be somebody
oh,
sick
oh,
today.
Mary, don't you weep.
If somebody here ain't got no home.
Oh, Mother, don't you
but listen, Pharaoh's
oh,
army. They got drowned in the sea one day. But I believe a man said, Mary,
oh, baby, don't you weep.
Your little sister don't have to mourn no
oh,
more.
Martha,
now listen, if I could right now,
I
want to tell you that I surely would now.
Oh,
put my foot on the rock,
children.
Stand on the rock where Moses stood one day. Because Pharaoh's eye,
oh,
that's what the Bible said, got drowned in the sea.
Oh,
one day.
Sea.
But I believe the man said, Mary.
Oh, baby,
he said, Mary.
Oh, baby, don't you weep.
He said, Mary.
Oh, baby, don't you weep.
Trouble in the land will be all over after a while.
Baby, don't you weep.
You won't have to give up right for wrong no more.
Baby, don't you weep.
And maybe it could have been a little hard to hear.
Baby,
and I believe Jesus said I better call a little bit louder.
Baby, don't you weep.
Wish I had somebody to help me call me.
Baby,
yeah, baby.
Oh, baby, don't you weep.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, baby.
I'll be your bridge over deep water if you trust in my name.
Oh, baby.
Tell Martha don't have to mourn no more.
That was the Reverend Claude Jeter with the Swan Silver Tones, a big influence on Al Green. And if you listen closely to that song, you might have heard Claude Jeter say, I'll be a bridge over deep water if you trust in my name. A phrase that inspired Paul Simon a few years later to write some song.
Here's our train, summer breeze and brilliant light. Only love she sees, she controls all love. Love sails to a new light. Promised you a miracle, belief is our beauty thing. Promises, promises. As golden days break wandering, only if she sees, he controls her love. Life is a curse, everything is possible. Promises, everything is possible. I song never wild. Lost you so quietly, slipping back on golden tides, breathing whispering memories. Promise to a miracle, a belief is a beauty thing. Promises, promises, I
around. Instinctively you give to me the love that I need. I cherish the moments with you. Respectfully I say to thee, I'm aware that you're cheating when no one makes me feel like you do. Upside down, boy, you turn me inside out and round and round. Upside down, boy, you turn me inside out and round and round. I know you got charm and appeal, you always play the field. I'm crazy to think you're all mine.
We started off, well before that, obviously, with Bob Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour on the Bible. Swan, Silver Tones with Mary, Don't You Weep. Then we had 1982, Simple Minds, Promise You a Miracle, the early, better, much better Simple Minds stuff. And, there was another couple of Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, Awful, sorry. But the early stuff was much better. And then we had The Teardrop Explodes from 1980, but kind of going backwards a little bit from 82 to 80. Have to have a bit of the sort of tail end of the 70s disco stuff there with Diana Ross in 1980. With Upside Down. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Martin was grooving away there, as you can imagine, I'm sure, to Diana Ross. All over the... It's very difficult to sort of pin him down and get him to sit down after a good old boogie. For some reason, he just cannot, kind of stay away from the dance floor. But anyway, Martin, to more serious matters now. And for me, the big news of this week has hardly been... Well, I don't know if it's been reported anywhere, which is this Tommy Robinson attack on the East Sussex Palestine Solidarity campaign, although it wasn't actually Tommy Robinson himself, it's the same bunch of people. Why would it be that a whole bunch of middle-aged and young thugs might go and beat up a bunch of pensioners?
It's the first I've heard of it, Tony. As you say,
it's called news, mate.
Yes, I know, but it's not been reported in the mainstream media, so we haven't heard of it. It's just there's an atmosphere of thuggish intimidation developing.
There certainly is. And I think, we've got a police service and we've got a Home Office that's hopeless when it comes to so many things, and particularly on this matter. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the former member of Palestine Action, now Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Surrey, that is to say Nick Georges.
My name is Nick Georges. I was protesting for Palestine. There were a group of about seven of us were protesting for Palestine on a bridge over the M25. We were hanging banners down. We were standing there with a few flags, and a group of about seven right-wing Tommy Robinson thugs approached us, came running up to us, and the leader grabbed the flag off my friend, my 64-year-old friend who was standing next to me, ripped it out of his hands, snapped the flag in two, ripped the flag off. I went over to ask him to stop doing that, to give us our flag back. And the next thing I remember was spinning across the tarmac, vaguely thinking, oh, perhaps he might have hit me. Now, this happened about 2 weeks ago on a bridge at Egham over the M25. And anyway, so I was spinning, I came to, I think he must have knocked me unconscious when he hit me. Well, I came to spinning across the tarmac and thinking, oh, maybe he hit me. And anyway, I hit the ground and fractured my skull. So he'd actually, what happened, he'd actually hit me on the side of the head so hard he obviously made me unconscious, because I don't remember being hit at all landing on the ground. And he then went on to attack two other members of our group. I was the worst injured. I was unconscious on the ground. Eventually an ambulance came, took me away. I was in NE for a night, and the next day they transferred me to a ear hospital because he damaged my ear as well. So for two or three days afterwards, I thought I was okay, but then it was like hit a brick wall, and psychologically I just went into deep fall. There were about seven of them all together in this attack, and they were, the leader was absolutely, like, he was so aggressive. He came running up. He was shouting, get that fucking flag out of my fucking face, not in this fucking country. And they're just so aggressive. And, you know, we've never seen him in our lives. And what we've noticed has been happening over the last month or so is an incredible rise. Every time we're trying to protest, there's a massive increase in the aggression and the violence against us. Absolutely incredible. You know, normally it's Zionists that are aggressive and violent against us, but this is not violence. This is your average white man in his van, your builder, whoever it is. It's your angry white man. And my take on it is Tommy Robinson, who's paid, funded, and totally supported by Israel. I mean, your average white man in the van, yes, they hate immigrants, they hate the boat people, but they haven't got a clue about Palestine. They're not interested in Palestine. They've never been there. They've got no interest at all. So my take on it is that Israel has used Tommy Robinson, it's used his reach amongst all the far right, and he's totally indoctrinated and propagandized all the far right to hate Palestine. This is all part of Israel's protesting and trying to crush us for protesting for Palestine. You know, a couple of my friends the other day, they were attacked by a far-right group again when they were protesting, had their phones ripped out of their hands and hurled to the ground. And, you know, we've seen people leaning out of cars, put the windows down, they're half out of their cars, giving us the finger and shouting the most aggressive and violent abuse at us. And we've not seen it to this extent. The last month has been like an explosion in this Tommy Robinson far-right fascist groups against all Palestine protectors, and it is quite alarming and very frightening. The police got involved. As far as I'm aware, the police are pursuing the case. We've made witness statements, and what will come of it, who knows. But, you know, in my book, there's no way that people should be able to get away with hitting a 73-year-old OAP in the side of the head so hard it knocks into the ground and he fractures his skull. It's not, it shouldn't be allowed to happen. And, you know, I sincerely hope we can take this person to court and give them a message that they can't get away with this sort of behaviour.
Well, I will definitely second that sentiment. I think it's very interesting that these right-wingers are so pro-Israeli,
As he says, they don't really know much about it apart from the fact that they're killing Muslims and they don't like Muslims. But of course, there's a huge amount of Israeli money which is going to the far right in this country.
Yeah.
Elon Musk, for example, and all these other people are bankrolling all of this. When Elon Musk spoke to the rally in London by video, he was saying, you may not want violence, but violence is coming to you. It's time to fight and die.
So maybe,
those are his words.
Maybe Musk is funding this program, which these... I mean, it seems obvious to me that... what Nick's saying there is that this has emerged over roughly the last month, that there's been lots more violent incidents with phones, people having their phones smashed up. Now, this is a way of, I suppose, it's just criminal damage or whatever. It's not actually violence against the person. But to snatch someone's phone and then smashing it, I mean, this seems to be off the back of this big rally that Tommy Robinson had about 6 weeks ago, wasn't it? That seems to have almost empowered a new street fighting thug movement.
It has, and of course, it's Elon Musk was openly calling for violence in Britain from his safe American home. Okay, and there's going to be a civil war and all the rest of it. We've already had one in this country, Tony, and two Tory prime ministers nearly died. The IRA were just unlucky on the day both times. And if the right wing want to have a street fight in this country, we may get one. But they may not like what happens as a result.
Yes, well, anyway, in the full version of that interview with Nick Georges, he does go into quite a lot of other aspects, including this whole idea of, Tony Blair, what's his reception like in the Middle East? But more importantly, what's been happening with the ceasefire? I mean, he doesn't believe there is really any ceasefire, and I suppose he's right. The Israelis are manufacturing almost every couple of days another excuse why the ceasefire can't hold, and they're also preventing a lot of aid from getting in there. Also the other thing Nick talks about in the longer interview is this attempt to ban Palestine Action, and he doesn't believe that it's going to be possible to overturn it through legal routes. There's so many powerful forces. I mean, particularly he talks about the Board of Deputies of British Jews in Britain, but the two main organisations he mentions are the Labour Friends of Israel and the Conservative Friends of Israel. So these two major parties, something like 80-90% of these parties are actually pro-Israeli.
Well, I don't know if it's 80 or 90%.
Well, he names the figures anyway.
But both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are on the back foot in the opinion polls, aren't they? What's also happening is that the Zionists have definitely decided that they want to work with the far right on an Islamophobic agenda. And of course, Tommy Robinson, I don't know if he's gone yet, he's going to get an all expenses paid trip to meet a government minister in Israel. A government minister should probably be put on trial and sent to prison for life. But Tommy is getting a free trip out there to say hello to them and have a chat. And of course, you can imagine that Tommy and people like him are having quite a good lifestyle out of all of this. They're living the life of Riley. Yeah. They're being paid all expensive paid trips. That they are now journalists like we are, Tony, but they get a lot more money than we are. We get nothing. They're getting loads of money, and it's all basically a planned. They're planning World War III, and that includes on the streets of our country.
It does. I mean, I find it amazing that the Home Office are not interested in, and the police don't seem to be interested in closing down these Robinson-type organisations. But anyway, when they did their rally, what was it called? Rally for the Nation or something. Lots and lots of people, I think, understandably, who were annoyed about the lack of patriotism of the British government, turned up at this rally. They're not necessarily racist at all. Some of them obviously are, but it seems to me that they're being kind of corralled and used, Martin.
Well, that's true. There's always going to be an element of people just joining in because they're joining in. I mean,
they like the flag, and they don't actually see the British government, whether it's Sunak or Starmer, as actually supporting Britain anymore.
Well, there's going to be... obviously going to be a different perspectives on all of these things. You could say that they've got a right to freedom of speech, and okay, I might accept that.
But we don't have
that right.
What's happening is they're trying to claim this British flag, the English flag particularly, as theirs.
Well, they can claim it if they like, but the question is, does it belong to them? And the answer is no, it doesn't. It belongs to everybody.
Well, it reminds me of that talk Bobby had a few weeks ago with Nick Griffin in the noughties, saying that, that he was approached by big American funders, saying that, oh, well, we would like to give you lots of money if you'll stop talking about the banking system, but most importantly, you'll start criticising Muslims exclusively.
Well, that's right. The agenda behind this is to demonise Muslims, and that was the idea behind 9/11, which wasn't carried out by Muslims. It was carried out by the deep state in the US working with Mossad, and we could spend all of the rest of this show explaining why that's true. Now, it didn't used to matter because people like us used to say these things, but tell you what, who does know these things? The Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, and the Chinese general staff. They know very well what happened in Syria was the British and the Americans put Al-Qaeda in power. The British and the Americans created, and the Israelis created Al-Qaeda in the 1980s to kill Russian soldiers. They know what's going on. And the world is going to war about all of these things, and Islamophobia in this country is one of the front lines of that war. But of course, they may overplay their hand here, because in actual fact, most people in this country are more fair-minded than that. And if you start to go around beating up 73-year-olds, somebody might say, hang on a minute, this is getting too far, going too far.
So it was 13th of September this year that this big rally took place. Now, one of the major attempts by the Tommy Robinson group is to talk about this thing called grooming gangs. Now, we know from John Wedger that actually child prostitution is not just taking place in Muslim communities, it's taking place in white communities in London, which is kind of being ignored, basically. But it was absolutely unbelievable to see at this rally, a short clip from the rally, where a young survivor of child abuse was put onto the stage, and she then starts explaining that she wasn't abused by a Muslim, she was abused by a white man. And as soon as she explains this, the people organising it basically grabbed her and pushed her off the stage. This is the sort of thing that goes on. Let's have a listen to a clip of that right now.
I am a victim of grooming. I was groomed when I was 11 years old, and I am disgusted with all of you here. I'm disgusted with all of you, because it was not an immigrant. It was multiple Muslims.
That's the organisers of the march there, so we're not interested in that. And she's just literally dragged off the stage, Martin.
Well, it's interesting because of the people who were arrested not this summer but last summer for attacks on mosques and asylum seekers' hotels. Virtually all of them had previous criminal convictions, like Tommy Robinson, but at least a third of them had criminal convictions for domestic violence. So these are the people who want to protect women and girls, except not their girlfriend whose teeth they've knocked out.
We heard last week that Fatima is okay, thank God. We're reporters after the death of Wafa al-Udaini over in Gaza, so I've been doing my best to try and keep getting reports from Gaza, and we've got a new reporter this week, someone called Junaid, who's reporting on her attempts to get back to northern Gaza, her failure, and then having to return back to southern Gaza, but still really having no home. This is what it's like for people in Gaza right now, despite this so-called ceasefire.
The United Nations announced the end of the war in the Gaza Strip, but for the citizens of Gaza, nothing has ended. In fact, the war has begun for me personally as a Gazan citizen who was forced to flee from northern Gaza to the south, where there is no shelter, no work and no money. We tried to return a few days ago to northern Gaza, but I couldn't reach my city Jabalia, because no one really understands anything about the yellow line declared by the occupation. In addition, the occupation left behind nothing but destruction. So, I returned to the south in despair. There is no shelter for me in either northern or southern Gaza. Speaking about the vegetarians of the ceasefire, one of the clauses is the entry of aid into the Gaza Strip and the opening of all crossings. As usual, the occupation has failed to comply as they delayed daily in opening the Palestinian crossings.
So, yeah, I mean, one of the things that people in, like her in Gaza were calling for is to these crossings to be reopened. The Israelis still haven't done it.
We were talking about the Rafah crossing there to bring aid in. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, there are several crossings, aren't there?
But well, the main one is Rafah. They just haven't allowed the aid to come. That's the trucks are all there, full of supplies, and they can't bring them in. This whole ceasefire scam is a trick by the US and the Israelis to divert people from the reality of what's going on.
So Nick Georges is right, is he?
Of course he is. I mean, everybody who's got any common sense can see that this is actually that Hamas agreed to the ceasefire because they're in a corner and they've got to be seen to be trying to make peace. So they're doing their best, but nobody believes that they're in anything that's going to happen here. And of course, the problem is for those who want to develop the Gaza Strip, because that's what Trump's talking about and Kushner and all the rest of it, is you've still got a 40,000 strong army buried in under Gaza in tunnels, and they're actually better trained, better armed, better motivated than they were at the beginning of the fight, because by fighting, you get good. And of course, they've got loads and loads and loads of this, literally thousands and thousands of unexploded bombs in the rubble.
In fact, some of them have been blowing up the Israelis are going past, and then they're blaming that on the Palestinians and then using that as an excuse to break the ceasefire.
Yes, indeed.
There are lots and lots and lots of lies that can be told.
What's Al-Qassim brigades? And of course, it isn't just Hamas. There are various factions within the Palestinian resistance forces. They've basically been able to get hold of loads and loads of explosives because the Israelis have been dropping American and British explosives all over Gaza. But of course, a lot of them haven't exploded, and they're there to be turned into improvised explosive devices. So I wouldn't like to be anybody going to Gaza to try and rebuild it against the will of the locals. And of course, the other thing they're doing is they've weaponized various criminal groups within the population, many of whom have got links with ISIS in Sinai, and also drug dealing and so on. And what they're trying to do now is create a civil war within the Gaza population by using these criminal groups. But of course, it hasn't really worked because Hamas have basically been eliminating them because they're traitors. And that's what happens to traitors.
A guy called Yossi Cohen is a former boss of Mossad, and he's been talking over in the UK quite a bit recently. There's a long interview with him, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But then here he is talking about, in fact, he has a whole section here about bragging, really, about their ability to do terrorism and admitting that they are basically a terrorist state. I mean, isn't that really what we're looking at with the Israelis ever since the 1940s? This is really just as simply a massive terrorist organisation.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the Irgun.
And they're bragging about it.
Yes. Well, that's right. And they're so confident.
We're on your side, they say.
Well, that's what they would say, wouldn't they? But it's not necessarily true, though, is it?
What Nick Georges says, I think, in the longer interviews, it's fantastic. If you get a chance to listen to it, please do. Is he said, look, if you ignore this now, this is coming to your doorstep. The sort of terrorism that the Israelis are inflicting on the Gazans, this is starting to spread. And it won't just stay in the Middle East. It will be coming for you.
That's right. I mean, there's a famous song by the Manic Street Preachers, which is based on a poster from the 1930s. If you tolerate this, then your children will be next, will be next.
Oh, maybe that sounds like a good one to have on next, wouldn't it? Anyway, it's Yossi Cohen.
Now, I'd make a case, I think, that Israel's international isolation is almost as much, if not more, of a security threat than certainly Hamas poses right now.
Of course it is.
So how do you account for such an enormous success on the physical side, but such an enormous defeat? Mm-hmm. I think we can say on the propaganda information war. How do you account for that imbalance?
First, I think that your description hurts, but it is the truth. And the fact is that we didn't fail. We just don't do it.
Mm. Didn't try.
Okay. We didn't even try to do it. At the beginning of the war, and Israel, by the way, is not doing it for many years. You have beautiful ambassadors out there. I mean, there is a Ministry of Foreign Affairs, full-fledged ministry. We're not using it. There's kind of a huge gap in between the Prime Minister's office and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for years. The Prime Minister's office does not respect the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, not like here in the UK. Okay, when I spoke to my counterpart at the MI6, he said, my boss is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Minister. Not the PM. Okay, it's a different thing. I mean, for deniabilities and liabilities and all that. I mean, there is, the Prime Minister could say, I was not aware of that, right? And, I mean, it's my ministers have decided that. But there is a huge gap in between what we can do and what we're doing. And I don't think that we even tried. I don't think that we've even tried. And for sure, the other side is trying so hard. And unfortunately, I mean, look at the Prime Minister's speech yesterday at the UN. It was an empty hall. There's no one there. Why? Isn't the UN meant to be the place for open conversation with all countries? Now, the president of Iran, a mass killer, would enter the site, same stupid, ugly green marble behind, which I know, and for many years I've been to the UN. Nobody would go. No one would leave. And where is it that we're in? What is the situation that we're in? Unfortunately, your description is absolutely right. And I think that what we have to do, we have to try do that. Explaining what the PR of the State of Israel could not be done only by the Prime Minister once in a while. You have to have a super huge division of people that are being recruited to that mission, would be happily being recruited that. You know how many people approach me and say, why don't we do that? Same question. Where are we? I mean, not only Jewish people around the world, but others too that do care about our existence and do believe that we have the right and the just and to fight Hamas and other terrorists around the world. What's happened? And you know, every time that the credit is going high, let's say after the pages, it crashes immediately down. We've done something very nice in Iran. I mean, because we had to, let's say, destroy the sites. I mean, it stays there at the beautiful positive PR for
5 minutes.
5 minutes, few days, boom, it crashes immediately down.
Yossi Cohen there talking on a podcast called The Brink. But he's, I mean, there's lots in that, but I mean, I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He's plugging his new book. But I mean, it's interesting to hear him talking about all the techniques that they use, but in a way, it's more interesting to hear him try and excuse the way that Israel is now so negatively viewed around the world. On the one hand, he seems to think it doesn't matter. And on the other hand, you know, he's saying, well, we can recover this at some point in the future, that it's been a complete PR disaster, but maybe they don't really care.
Well, I think the problem for them is that it is a PR disaster because in actual fact you're evil and you're carrying out evil acts. And of course the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court have actually named these evil acts. It's genocide and occupation. The International Court of Justice this week said that they've got to get out of occupied territory, they've got to provide humanitarian supplies to the population. You know, the jury is out and in, you know, it's all clear, they are in the wrong. And that's clear. Now, that means that people like Keir Starmer, Nigel Farage, Donald Trump, Macron, all of these people who are supporting them are complicit in genocide, and this is World War III. This is going to be the cause of World War III, and they've got nuclear weapons, okay? So they could use them. That's how serious this is. And if history books come to be written, everybody will know who was on the right side and who was on the wrong side. But of course, it's quite possible none of us are going to survive this. So the Israelis could end up with all of
this,
dead.
Martin, isn't a lot of this just about fear? The idea is actually controlling people by threatening them with economic destruction, with nuclear war, this sort of thing. The idea is that if people think that that might be about to happen, they're much more easily to move.
That's right. So it's about fear, but you inculcate fear in people by harming them. Yeah, it's not just getting into their minds and gaslighting them. You kill them, you hurt them, you kill their children. That creates fear, doesn't it? But it also creates anger and determination.
Well, I noticed quite a lot of talk about the, you know, whether or not Israel is a Jewish state. Is it or not?
Well, they claim they are, but they don't represent all Jews. And by any stretch of the imagination, lots of Jews despise them because they're criminals and warmongers.
Anyway, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro in New York had this to say.
The people here that you see and thousands that you don't see lined up on Second Avenue here in Manhattan in front of the Israeli consulate are here to protest the State of Israel's attempt to force Orthodox Jews into their army. Now, when people think of Israel, they may think it's a strange thing that Jews don't want to fight in its army. After all, is Israel not the Jewish state? Is Zionism not a manifestation of Judaism? Is Zionism not the national liberation movement of the Jewish people? And we're here to answer all those questions with a resounding no, it is not. Zionism is not Judaism. In fact, Zionism stands in opposition to Judaism. Judaism stands in opposition to Zionism. Zionism was created, actually, to negate Judaism. Zionism was created to erase the identity of regular Torah-abiding Jews and in their place create what the Zionists refer to as, quote, the new Hebrew man. Zionism exists to eradicate the values of Judaism. Zionism exists to replace and repeal Judaism. The differences between Judaism and Zionism could not be more enormous. Judaism is a religion. Its adherents follow the Torah, which was given to Moses and the Jewish people at Mount Sinai in the desert. And that is where the Jewish people were born. As the Bible says, Hayom hazeh nihyeh sol ha'am. Today, the Jewish people were born. We became a people. The Zionists believe that the Jewish people are a national identity, not merely a religious identity. They believe that the Jewish people are an ethnic identity, perhaps even, as Vladimir Jabotinsky believed, a racial identity. But whatever they believe, they think that being a Jew is more than being a member of a religion. The connection between all the Jewish people is not national. We are not one political nation. We are Am Yisrael, or you could call us the Ummah Yisraelis, the Jewish Ummah, which is a religious community. The only thing binding us together is our Torah. According to Zionism, what binds Jews together is a land, language, and a culture.
So, yeah, this is a rabbi in New York's explaining the very big differences between Zionism and Judaism at a protest outside the Israeli consulate there.
Yes, well, I mean, it's very clear that, you know, Orthodox Jews, many of them, not all, but many of them do not identify as Zionists. That's why they won't serve in the army. And, of course, at one stage at the beginning of this conflict, you know, the recent part of the conflict, in the Orthodox parts of Jerusalem where the Orthodox Jews are in the majority, they were flying Palestinian flags and the Israeli police were beating them up. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, there's still an issue about, you know, can you just come in here and, you know, they don't want to serve in the army, but I mean, you are here and this land didn't in fact belong to you. You turned up. But on the other hand, there are splits within and of course there's plenty of secular Jews who are opposed to Zionism because they think it's a racist ideology.
Well, there's a sort of political Zionism and religious Zionism, and they're both quite complicated. Religious Zionists, some of the religious Zionists, that is to say the people inspiring the parties that are now in the far right bloc in Israel, they believe that God is not going to help them, that they have to do this for God, whereas some of the religious Zionists say, well, what are you doing picking up guns for God? You know, that's not the way it should work. We should wait for God to do something, and then that's what we should do. So there's a complete, there seems like religious Zionism particularly is at daggers drawn. It's completely divided.
Well, I mean, the point is that there's actually, they used to have a joke, you know, three Jews, three different opinions. Yeah,
so well, you could say the same about the left.
Well, you could say the same about anybody.
Yeah,
but the thing is that religious Zionists believe that they will go to the Holy Land, to Zion, on the final day. You know, when the Messiah comes. And it's up to God to decide that, not you. All you've got to do is keep praying wherever you are in the world. You don't have to go to Israel physically. You keep praying, and then on the day of judgment, it'll all come to pass.
You're the sort of guy that likes to get things done by the gun rather than just praying.
Well, I'm not a religious Jew, Tony.
No.
Obviously.
So there's a big difference, though, isn't there, between getting things by the gun or prayer?
Well, indeed, there is, obviously. Preferably, things should be done through prayer and through negotiation. But the reality is, as we all know, that's not how the world actually works on a day-to-day basis.
There's a bit of bad luck for Donald Trump this week, wasn't there? I don't know if you saw this. He gave a speech on a US aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz, to all the crew there, talking about how wonderful it all was going. Apparently recruitment in the United States, because of all the patriotism drummed up by Trump into all the armed forces, is at an all-time high, because they've been having all sorts of trouble, just like the British Army is, in getting anybody to join it, because they don't actually believe in the wars. They see it as some sort of corrupt tool, and they're not really interested in fighting evil wars or on the wrong side of a battle. But at the same time, the same day, actually, as he was on the USS Nimitz, both of these ships in the Pacific, I think the Nimitz is in the South China Sea, another one of his aircraft carriers, the George Washington, actually no, he was on the George Washington and the Nimitz, you had a helicopter and an aircraft crash into the sea the same day. It's not looking good. I mean, do you think the Chinese are rubbing their hands watching the Americans, thinking, well, there's a lot of aircraft carriers circling around here and a lot of hot air from Donald Trump, but actually it doesn't seem like their aircraft or their helicopters really work, or they can't fly them very well?
Well, I think it's a very dangerous moment in world history, both in the South China Sea, in Palestine, in the Ukraine, and of course the things in Yugoslavia ain't looking that good, Tony. I mean, that could kick off again. All of these, and don't forget the world economy is going into probably one of the biggest depressions in history. At that point, things really do start exploding, because the pie is getting smaller, so somebody has to lose.
Well, meanwhile, domestically, it's not actually going that well for Donald Trump, is it? What with the government shutdown? Let's have a listen to this report now.
So, Mark, this US government shutdown, 28 days and counting.
Yeah, astonishing, really. The shutdown entered its fourth week, and in a week it will be the longest federal government shutdown in United States history. The Senate still deadlocked. 60 senators need to vote positively to approve Donald Trump's funding bill and therefore reopen the government. At the moment, the Republicans only have 54 senators on their side. We're now into the 14th round of voting and counting.
Yeah, the public, the workers, the unions, they're all watching this with an increasing despair. The largest federal workers union, it's urging the politicians to come up with some kind of stopgap solution, at least to make sure that people get paid. More than 700,000 are still in work, not getting paid. More than 600,000 have been furloughed. That is a lot of empty pay packets.
Yeah, it is indeed. Lots to get into here. We'll explain why it's all happening in a moment. But the tangible impact is huge. So many people literally not being paid. The individual personal knock-on is huge. Paying bills, defaulting on credit cards, mortgages, and on and on. There are many different groups of people that we could focus on. One is air traffic controllers and border staff. They're two groups of federal workers that everyone's watching, because chaos at the airports in the past has been the area that has broken the congressional deadlock. So far, they have been largely turning up to work, despite picking up paychecks of $0 for the first time on Tuesday. In fact, CNN got their hands on one of those paychecks. And if you're watching the vodcast rather than listening to us, you can see that on our podcast on YouTube. I've got a friend, James, who's high up in one of the major American airlines. I've been talking to him quite a bit on the sidelines of my kids' weekend football games. That, incidentally, is where most of the important chat comes from.
Well, That's where parents come to blows, right?
Right, exactly, exactly. We've been talking, he and I have been talking politics. He told me at the weekend that he was surprised, and many of his colleagues within the aviation industry were surprised that there hadn't already been significant chaos with workers just not able or not willing to turn up. He said that any day now, airports will reach a tipping point and it will be chaos.
Yeah, well, he was right, because we are beginning to see that international airports like Denver and Atlanta, they're now starting to have delays because some air traffic controllers are staying at home instead of choosing to work for free. You know, this is a people story, and we're getting to that stage where real people are beginning to feel it.
So I'm not quite sure what that report was from. I think it's LBC News talking about it, Martin. But look, I mean, this is bizarre, isn't it? So Donald Trump has been putting a National Guard on the streets in cities, but then at the same time, he's not paying government civil servants. There is also, I mean, there's just been literally 45 minutes ago a judgment in the US courts about food stamps. So they're saying that that Donald Trump is trying to stop food stamps, and the judge has been blocking Trump's administration from blocking the food stamps. But if people haven't got food, they are going out onto the street to riot, aren't they? So that seems to be almost, I mean, deliberate, you know. So get the National Guard out on the streets in the big cities, and then they just take away people's food and money and even any civil servants' money.
Well, it's a multi-faceted crisis, isn't it?
And it's taken a month for the pay packet to arrive on the doorstep this week, which says zero, no money's going into your account at all.
Yeah, and ultimately, of course, what do you think that does to the growth in the economy if people got no money to spend?
What's your opinion on how deliberate this is? It seems the sort of thing that Elon Musk will be rubbing his hands at. He's a multimillionaire. He doesn't really get on with Donald Trump anymore. And now apparently Congress is not going to be paying civil servants in the United States. It sounds like a total disaster, but is it deliberate?
Well, what's happening is that the Democrats, who, you know, they've got the capacity to block what Trump wants to do with his budgets. And that they're taking that because they don't agree with a lot of what he wants to do. So they're saying, you know, unless you agree with us about things like keeping food stamps, whatever, the demands that we are making, we are not going to sign this bill into law. And this happens periodically in the US. Yeah. And this is just this is just the biggest standoff they've had. But underlying all of this is the fact that the US is massively in debt. Yeah. Massively in debt, which is why they have to keep trying to roll it over and try and decide who's going to pay the price for resolving this. And of course, the Democrats, in a half-hearted way, are saying, well, we shouldn't be doing this on the backs of the poor. It should be the wealthy who have to pay. And the wealthy are saying, no, it should be the poor. So there we are.
Okay,
class warfare.
On Ukraine this week, there's something called the Burevestnik. And the Poseidon, the Burevestnik being a nuclear-powered cruise missile which can fly around the world and loiter and then go and bang somewhere if it feels like it, as well as the Poseidon, which is like a sort of mini-submarine that can go chugging around the world for months and months and then suddenly blow up in a harbour in America. So the Russians seem to be, although they're not actually testing nuclear weapons, they're testing all sorts of new delivery systems that can get them in and get them in there fast. They're also testing all sorts of defensive systems. The Russians really do seem to be preparing for World War III. And as a result of all this, last night Donald Trump announced that they are going to now resume nuclear weapons testing in America after the 1992 last underground test and the 1963 nuclear test ban treaty.
Well, I've been reading about this, and if you actually look at what Trump says, like a lot of what Trump says, it's not exactly clear what he's actually meaning here.
Well, he says he's going to be testing nuclear weapons, but how?
Yes, well, there's two things about that. The only way he can do nuclear tests is he's got to get that through Congress, in theory. He could ignore Congress, but then we're moving to a post-constitutional United States. Yeah? So he could perhaps do that. But, of course, the other side are going to say, well, if you're going to do that, then we're going to do that. The reason why we don't have tests of nuclear weapons anymore is there's an agreement to stop doing it. Now, if the Americans just unilaterally decide that they're going to start doing it again, then everybody else is going to start doing it. The real problem for them is this Baryshnik missile, whatever it's called, is that this isn't about Ukraine. This is about going toe-to-toe with the United States. If you, for example, fire one of your missiles into Russia and hit the Kremlin, we're going to fire back at the White House, okay? Because we can. They can fire directly from Siberia and hit the White House or number 10 Downing Street or Plymouth Naval Base within 20 to 25 minutes. That can happen. So the war won't be in Ukraine anymore. The war will be round the corner.
I think the Burevestnik is faster than 25 minutes.
No, it isn't, because what that is, it's not fast. It just stays in the air and hides and moves around. Yeah. So that can actually, it can stay in the air for weeks and months. Yeah. And it just keeps moving around. And, of course, you can have it flying over the Atlantic. Yeah, one of the things they could do is have loads of them flying over the Atlantic and the Pacific just outside of the US's territorial waters. It's perfectly legal, absolutely legitimate.
This is an extraordinary weapon system. And for many, many years after Putin first announced its potential existence in that speech he gave in 2018, there were many serious doubts that it would ever actually appear. I know that there were several people who thought that technologically it was impossible. Well, like a lot of things that people say are technologically impossible, apparently, it has now been brought to the point where it is not, its development process is completed and it is now entering serial production. And it is going to enter service with the Russian military fairly soon. So this is a cruise missile. It's bigger than the cruise missiles that we know, the Tomahawk and the KH-101 and all of those, but not massively big. It's about twice as big. And it's similar. It's subsonic. It's stealthy. It gets its power from a miniature nuclear reactor. And that, by the way, in itself is a massive technological breakthrough, miniaturizing a nuclear reactor so that you can insert it into a cruise missile. It means that the Russians now have miniature nuclear reactors that have developed the technology to produce miniature nuclear reactors, and they can presumably use them for all sorts of other purposes, small submarines, in all kinds of other weapons. Let's not get into that as well. I mean, this could potentially have important civilian applications as well. But the point is, this particular cruise missile can be launched. It's launched from the ground, apparently. It can take incredibly long, complex journeys. So it's impossible to develop air defenses that are pointing in every conceivable direction all the time. Even if you can have the missiles, the radars, it becomes very difficult. It can conduct apparently complex, evasive maneuvers whilst in flight, which strongly suggests to me that it has an AI component.
So that's, another LBC clip there. Martin, this is a completely new, different type of weapon, as you say, subsonic, so it will take maybe 25 minutes, half an hour, maybe a couple of hours to work its way to its target. But it seems that it's going to be very low level, very difficult to detect, and it could come at you from any direction at all, and it could have been up there for days. The other thing is, of course, this nuclear-powered propulsion system. This is something completely new.
Well, what the Russians are demonstrating with their nationalized arms industry that isn't done for profit is that we're going to run you ragged because your privatized arms industry, which is for profit, can't do this because nobody wants to develop something like this because they can't make a profit out of it. So they haven't bothered. In actual fact, the Russians aren't constrained by that. Now, what this really means and what the US really needs to take on board is that the continental United States is absolutely vulnerable. So if you start firing missiles into Russia, then we can fire them back at you. Because previously, they're on the other side of the ocean. They think they can do anything they want to everybody and nobody can touch them. that is no longer the case. It is quite possible if we go to war that the Russians will be able to take out military targets inside the United States very quickly and kill hundreds or possibly thousands of US military personnel. And they can't fire back because they ain't got anything to fire back with.
Trump's announcement about resuming nuclear testing, this has come just at the end of January next year. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, the START Treaty, expires.
That's right. So in actual fact, the Russians all along have said, why don't we stick to the treaties that we made years ago?
This is the last remaining nuclear arms treaty.
The last remaining one. And what Putin has said is, we will carry on working it for one more year. What we really need to do is sit down and get back to all the treaties that we previously had. But if you don't want those treaties, then we won't have them. And then we will go to war, and then you will lose. That's what's going to happen. You need to think again.
Another bit of story that's come out this week in the Virginia Giuffre memoirs is that apparently she was beaten up and raped by Ehud Barak, who was a former Israeli prime minister. It's difficult to know anything about this book since Virginia herself has died, almost certainly bumped off. And more and more stuff about Andrew. He's kind of going up to Balmoral now, apparently. But the point here is that the bigger picture is that there's some very violent, nasty people were going over to Epstein Island, and one of them was Ehud Barak. Apparently, he was delighting in throttling her.
Well, I mean, this is the whole point about what we're dealing with here. This is, they're criminals. I mean,
he's a psychopath, this guy.
They're psychopathic criminals. And of course, they use all of this stuff for blackmail. And of course, it's now coming. I mean, we've been banging on about Andrew all week. Andrew. And I want to say Mossad, because they run this country, or they think they do. Yeah. And that's what we're up against. People like that who are gangsters and criminals.
In Ukraine, Kiev's forces have encircled Krasnomeysk, also known as Potrovsk, Dmitriov, and also Kupiansk. These are all Ukrainian forces completely surrounded by the Russians.
That's right.
The Russians are saying, look, we're going to have a moratorium if you want to get your press people and civilians out of the area. And the Ukrainians are saying, no, don't believe them.
Well, that's right. I mean,
it's a bit like Israel. They don't want these journalists getting out because they don't want what's going on in there getting out.
No, I mean, and they haven't actually sealed them in completely either. So that they could, they've got them under fire control. So if they try and leave, they will kill them on the way out. Yeah. But they don't actually, like in the old days, in World War II, you'd seal a pocket like that. You'd seal it completely. They don't,
then everyone would surrender inside.
Well, that's right. They might surrender or they might not. But don't forget, in where they're fighting is mostly Russian speaking civilians in these towns. So that's why the Russians have tried to avoid going into having fights. You know, they try and surround the town rather than fight their way in there, because the civilians in the town are, and I was reading that in Kupiansk and all these other places, the Ukrainians are saying, we've got to leave now because the Russians are coming, and people say, no, we want to stay, because in actual fact we want the Russians to win. And that's there's a whole proportion of the population in the East Ukraine that's actually Russian speaking. They're on the wrong side of the current front line, but they'd be quite happy if the Ukrainians withdrew and the Russians took over, because that's what they want.
Ultimately, what's going to happen, do you think, with Ukraine? Is it going to be a spark off a World War III, is it going to be a deal?
I don't think there's going to be a deal. There's no possibility of a deal because the West and the Ukrainians are incapable of making deals.
Or isn't Putin incapable of doing a deal? Why hasn't Putin done a deal?
Because the other side, there are three deals, there have been three Minsk agreements, one is Istanbul and two Minsk agreements, and they were all viable deals, but the West didn't want those deals. And also, they double-crossed the Russians twice at Minsk. Yeah. And at that point, how many times are you going to double-cross me before I say to you, right, I'm not doing any deals with you, because you can't be trusted? Now, the Putin, for his own domestic reasons and also in terms of, appealing to the rest of the world, is going out of his way to say, I will talk to you, but we're not just going to do what you want, because we've got too much at stake here.
Thanks, Patrizia. We've got this week's poem now. The Keystone, a.k.a. Key Drone Flops. What a farce. What a joke. Integrity went up in smoke. Let loose to roam the streets, it seemed, with half a ton in pocket gleaned. Protests his guilt to all who would listen to or be understood. Drones and CCTV on hand to track him down. Oh, what a plan. To show the boys in blue were tops. Instead, we saw the Keystone flops. The narrative, all migrants bad. The proof in PUD, we've all been had. Tommy Robin, some, and backers, while Zionists all want to track us. A fallen force is plain to see. Behind closed doors, fate accompli. What's real? Who knows? On Chump TV, the news that skews most all we see. Brainwashed to squash the facts, surprising. Merged tales so tall, confusion rising. Melissa's might for climate change did its worst. More pain than gain. More blur to fur the arteries. So facts from truth we never see. Dark games to blame. Divide and conquer. A society gone. Truly. Bonkers. Well, it is on TV anyway. Thanks, Patrizia. This is what she's referring to is a story which was broke actually while we were on air last week, as they sometimes do, about this guy who was accidentally released, accidentally on purpose released, and then went trotting around London. He was actually trying himself to stay in jail, saying, "You can't release me, you're not allowed to." But then we had almost like a sort of live TV chase of him with bits of pieces of footage, and I have no idea how anyone recognised him and knew it was him and filmed him and then sent it into the television. Maybe this was a bit of a psyop here. And the guy is eventually arrested on Sunday. So you've got this sort of 48 hours of manic news about this guy who, it seems to me, has been deliberately let out so that he can create some sort of anti-migrant storm.
Well, I think that's over-egging it. I think in actual fact, there's lots of people are released by accident from our disorganised prisons, and many of them are dysfunctional, Tony, and that's why lots of people are having to be released, because we've got no room in the prisons, yeah, because we've got far too many people in them and we haven't spent enough on staffing them and all the rest of it, and therefore they don't really function that well, and that's another thing. You see, we've got money to burn in the Ukraine, but we can't even run a prison system.
It's Halloween. We haven't had a Halloween show for a while, I don't think, on a Friday. Tonight, mapped Britain's witchcraft hotspots revealed as 13,000 declare as witches in the UK. With sorcery more popular than ever, how weary of real-life witches should you be in your neighbourhood this Halloween? So this is actually a couple of years ago from the Daily Express, but it is quite interesting. It's at the time of the census. What they've done is they've said, have a look at this map. You can see whereabouts most the witches in Britain are. So do you know where they are, Martin?
Bristol?
No. Well, have you inside information? No,
you've got the inside information.
Well, supposedly. Anyway, Cornwall, apparently, is where most of them are. But what do you know about witchcraft and the beliefs in that sort of thing?
It's a relatively modern phenomenon, you know. It's a spin-off from the 60s, largely.
Well, hang on, it goes back a lot further, doesn't it? So when did it change, if it did change?
I'm just saying that modern people who identify as witches, which is what we're talking about, this is a relatively modern phenomenon.
Listen, it goes back thousands of years,
yes, of course it does. The idea of witches is very old. Of course it is.
What do they believe?
Sorry?
What do they believe?
Well, you'd have to ask them.
Your sister's a witch, isn't she?
She was at one stage involved
but what
in
witchcraft. What did she believe?
Well, there's a whole farrago of things that people believe.
Isn't it a kind of nature worship?
It's a kind
sort of
thing. Nature worship and all the rest of it, you know. And it's you know, but modern, I mean, Ronald Hutton, who is a professor at the university here, is a modern historian, really, but he writes books about it. I've read his book this summer. About Druidism, you know, modern Druidism, yeah? Because in actual fact, you know, the Druids died out thousands of years ago.
And they were nobbled by the Romans, weren't they?
Well, yeah, that's right. But, I mean, and the knowledge we have of what they actually believed is fairly limited. It's limited to, you know, some archaeology and you know,
in the Victorian era, there was quite a lot of research, and I think it was one of the Welsh bards, Taliesin, had written loads about the... Druid lore, because it was hanging on in Wales, actually.
Well, I mean, that's what he claimed.
After after the Romans, I mean, they didn't completely wipe it out. They weren't stupid, were they, the old ancient Britons? Is they hung around in places where the Romans weren't actually there and active. And they practiced many of these faiths behind closed doors. Well,
that is what was claimed by people in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Don't you think that there was a preservation of this old... of these old ways? Not at all. Okay.
No, I've just been reading Ronald Hutton's book about all of this. It's very interesting because he's saying this is actually worthy of study in its own right. Is that, you know, as the West de-Christianized, if you like, in the 17th and 18th centuries, then people, Ossian, for example, was supposedly a bard in Scotland and he wrote an epic poem about Scotland and everybody thought that it was real. But in actual fact, it was actually made up by a guy pretending that he'd written it down from an old manuscript. In actual fact, that wasn't the case. He just made it all up. And I think people are very imaginative, Tony. Some people are into aliens and spaceships and UFOs. Others are into witchcraft. I don't really believe in either of them, but people are people. They're going to believe whatever they want to believe.
The Druids were surely a kind of English version of the Phoenicians, because the Phoenicians were doing a lot of trading at the time.
The Druids weren't English, because the English weren't even in England at that time. Yeah, they were still in Denmark. So they weren't English, they were British, they were Celtic. They were Celtic holy figures. But we've got very limited information about the Druids. You know, the Romans wrote a little bit about it, but apart from that, we don't know that much.
The thing with Taliesin is if I've pronounced that right, have I? Taliesin.
Yes, this is a Welsh...
He was around the 4th century, and...
It was later than that, I think. We'd have to look it up, Tony.
I'm just looking here. 4th century. And, so he had at least a chance of knowing a little bit about the pre-Roman world. Anyway, so that's... what I might do, I'll see if I can... There are a couple of good books about... written in the Victorian era about looking at these old Druidic traditions. So I will share some of those. I think fascinating. But, Ronald Hutton is not the only person who's been looking into this. Over the years, one of my favourites, so I've read both of her books. One is called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, and the other is The God of the Witches. She's Margaret Murray, and amazingly, she was, well, not that amazingly, in 1957, she was interviewed for the TV, some programme called Out of Step, talking about her anthropological studies into witchcraft.
Dr. Murray, have you ever met a witch yourself?
I've seen a witch. I didn't meet her. She was a farmer's wife, and I saw her on the road, and I passed close by her and had a good look, and I thought she was one of the most disagreeable people I'd ever seen.
Now, what sort of powers did she have?
Well, she claimed to be able to... She was credited. I don't know whether she claimed it. She was credited with being able to kill the animals, the farm animals. And the other farmers' wives were terrified of her.
And do you believe that she did, in fact, have special power?
No, I don't think she did. But I think she made the other people believe that she could. And it's a paying thing to be a witch of the kind, you know. Because you get presents in order not to use your power.
Would you say that all witchcraft is in fact trickery then?
Well, that kind of witchcraft certainly is.
I believe that you do get letters, don't you, from people who think they are under spells.
Yes, and I have had several, and I always tell them that if they think they're bewitched, they will be bewitched. If they will stand against it, they won't be bewitched. I tell them to have courage and not to be bewitched.
Do many people join witches' covens today?
Well, there are a certain number of young people that do. And I think it's largely because they think it's rather daring and adventurous. Young people are always out for something daring and different. But I think it is really that they prefer to be called a member of the witch coven rather than a member of a nudist colony. It's more romantic.
You certainly wouldn't advise anyone to join them, would you?
Well, I don't know how well it might lead to. I think they're a little inclined to play with powers and fire that they don't understand.
Did the witches ever do any good?
Oh, yes. They were the healers. They were the doctors. And because there were no other doctors, And they were also, the women were also the midwives in the villages. And of course, as doctors, they had to know about herbs. And a doctor, there's one person in England that knows more about poisons than anybody else. It's the doctor. He has to.
Then witchcraft has been as much an influence for the good as for the bad.
I certainly think it was. And when it's at its best, it was certainly for the good. And now it's dead, you can hardly say.
Now, one thing I've always been slightly terrified of myself is the idea of a wax image and sticking pins into it.
Well, according to the what I can find out is this. People made wax images and stuck pins into them. And that had no effect on the victim. Then they went to something worse. And you very often find that it was poison that they used. That was the case with James the First, our James the First, when the witches tried to get rid of him. They made a wax image and destroyed it. They also did a conjuring with cats, and that had no effect. And then they reverted to poison.
So that's the voice of the wonderful Margaret Murray. Her various books, The Witch Cult in Western Europe and The God of the Witches. And Dave is pointing out that Sanskrit is actually related, Martin, to some of the Celtic languages. Is that right? That's basically that's saying right. Hinduism, they're all in Hinduism and Druidism.
Yes, they're all Indo-European languages. And so some languages in Europe aren't Indo-European. Hungarian, for example, isn't Indo-European. They came from somewhere else. But Indo-European languages are very common in Europe, and Sanskrit is an Indo-European language in India.
Well, one of the things I find so fascinating is the similarity between the Phoenician written language and the Viking or the Norse runes. They're very similar looking, and this was, of course, was a big breakthrough in human civilization. I mean, unfortunately, it was the Phoenicians, these maniac head choppers, that did it. Was that the idea is that rather than have a symbol representing something as part of your language, you have a symbol representing the sound. So that was how the Phoenicians maybe got their name through phonetics.
Well, I think that phonetics probably comes from the Phoenicians, is probably what you've
had. Maybe, yes, it might well be.
Yes, of course, alphabetic languages clearly are superior in many ways in terms of user friendliness than ideographic languages like Chinese. But of course, if it's like having a QWERTY keyboard, you can't actually, Chinese has developed in the way it has, and it's got advantages and disadvantages. Obviously, alphabetic languages have got a huge advantage because you can make anything with an alphabetic language and you can read it straight away, whereas you've got to learn thousands and thousands of ideograms to be able to read Chinese.
Yeah, a bit of a breakthrough. Anyway, finally tonight, just to kind of bring things down to earth finally, this S. Williamism. I'm not quite sure, I'm not sure if he's sure exactly what his name is, but he has been around for a long time online as a YouTuber. I rather like him. He's a fine arts student from London that goes around doing all sorts of interesting kind of wanders on his own. And he's done one a few days ago about London he calls it his London Occult Art Review of 2025. And he believes he can see a lot of these occult symbols in London's propensity for closed circuit television everywhere.
I made a video many, many years ago about going to King's Cross Station when they just spent an enormous amount of money before the Olympic Games to build a new sort of flying saucer on it. And I got kicked out essentially because I was upset with all of the CCTV they were installing. But I realized then that whenever they spend extraordinary amounts of money on one of these massive projects, they do, of course, take the opportunity to build some kind of new, dazzling, sparkling surveillance machine, which I believe they have done so here. Although not much noise is being made about it, London is changing. The smart city agenda is alive and kicking and moving at quite a pace, and you can be sure that the transport network will be at the heart of the data collection needed to run it. So these sparkly balls, infinite accumulation of photons, to me, it's describing TfL's totally pervasive CCTV capturing, which is almost total coverage. So for me, these little balls, each of them is like the image from a CCTV camera. A reminder that when I enter the transport network, my identity is recorded and my location is tracked. But they don't need to track my location because I will tell them.
Yeah, you'll tell them just by your face. Maybe the only way to go around London in the future is going to be Martin with a little balaclava on and just little eye slits and maybe some sort of maybe dark glasses over those eyes so your retina can't be scanned by all these cameras everywhere, scanning your face and scanning your retinas.
Interestingly enough, of course, on 7-7, the cameras didn't work at all.
Oh,
and we've
dear.
Got no photographs of the guys who went to supposedly bombing London. They came the previous week, and they had loads of pictures of that, but on the day itself, no footage whatsoever. So all of that coverage, checking on everybody, no use at all on that day, was it?
Nope. So anyway, it's a war on God, but God's going to win. I suppose I should say something about the interesting similarities between the initiation rites in witchcraft and Freemasonry. I hope that hasn't passed anyone by. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, of course, to Nick Georges and our other guests and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Mustn't forget Steve Hall either. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group. It's been pointed out to me it's not a channel, Tony, it's a group. Okay, so maybe I should try and make it a channel. I'm not sure if there's any point in that. But anyway, that's also, all these things are linked on the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, story tips, story links, and comment page. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter that comes out by email. And if you can afford it, do please donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Particularly thanks to all that do so at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Just send an email to tony@cultureshop.org.uk with newsletter subscribe in the headline, and I should add you to the next week's list. So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream. Do please make live recordings as we're streaming from Bristol here on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and holylandradio.com that's between 11 and 2:30 p.m. Central Time and 97.7 FM in, if you happen to be in West Sweden, Wisconsin. And also live, of course, on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Get an updated version from GitHub, please, if you haven't already done that in the last couple of weeks. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
The very thought of you, more.